Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And just like that, we're back with Fight Night Picks, set to close out a busy 2022. I can't wait for it. UFC Fight Night Strickland. He's going to be challenging, taking on Jared Cannonier, who's coming off an unsuccessful title bid his last time out at UFC 276. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, the prediction champion from this year, Record Scratch. I'm looking to take that away from a Matt Allen respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. Matt, we got to let people in on the news because you've been on top for all of this year. And I'm creeping up on your friggin' heels. And so if we do look at it, I'm four off from the season total. And then we said Dana White's Contender Series counts.
No, we didn't. You said that.
We did. I had two better on you there. So I'm two away, and you're looking to break the cycle here. You've had a heck of a year. We both have, really.
Yeah, it has been a really good year. I think both of our percentages have improved.
Oh, they're up quite a bit.
Which is really nice to see. It is wild bending the rules for Craig at the end of the year, but
we're going to make one pick each. Now, maybe it's the same pick, maybe it's not, but we're going to preview and profile all the fights. We're going to make one pick each, and that one goes to our overall tally and scorecard on the year.
It has been a really good year for both of us. The good thing is, we both had some momentum going into the end of the year. We both had a really good pay-per-view last week.
Let's go!
And it was a good pay-per-view to watch. That's what I will have to say. I know there was some controversy in the co-main and the main event, but still, I know there was a pay-per-view that we both may not have been all that high on going into, but at least up until the main card, or at least the last two fights of the main card, it was a Just Bleed card if there ever was one. Finishes left, right, and center. Some crazy comebacks. It was a really entertaining one, and I think we have a lot of similarities between that last fight night card, that last pay-per-view, and this fight night card might not be the most famous people competing in the main event or the co-main event, but it's a very deep card that we have ahead of us this weekend.
And it really is. I mean, the judges probably weren't fans of Bret Hart back in the late 90s, but if you do look ahead to this weekend's card, 9 ranked fighters on this one, and if you go back, the last fight night card, 9 ranked fighters, the last pay-per-view, 9 ranked fighters, this one follows suit. Again, you have a couple of guys that got really close to the top of the middleweight division, a couple of guys that have main evented some shows in the past, and a positive main event experience as well in Strickland and Cannonier. But you go down through this card, the co-main event, that could be the main event of a fight night. Armin Tsarukyan taking on the former M1 global champ, Demir Ismagulov. And even the first fight that's on this card, Sergey Morozov also came over out of kind of the dissolving promotion that was M1 Global. He was a champ over there taking on Journey Newsom. There's a lot of very, very fun fights. But Matt, when we really try and condense it, 14 fights total on this card, you got to pick two fight of the nights. You guys know what time it is. Time for the Fight Night Picks Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
All right, you kind of have to cherry pick up off the top, but Armin Tsarukyan's last time out, Fight of the Night, when he was taking on Mateusz Gamrot, a lot of people were disappointed in the judges. They thought that Armin Tsarukyan won, and for Demir Ismagulov, a lot of people thought Guram Khachatladze won in his last fight. But for both of these guys, they have that fan-friendly type of style. They can get it done in all different aspects of mixed martial arts. And that's what makes this one so much fun.
This is an incredibly well-matched fight. And that's the good thing about both these guys. For Ismagulov, he has felt like the boogeyman for a long time now. You keep on being told about all of his skills and his well-rounded skill set. And I feel like we have started to see that. The more he has been able to compete against some of these higher-level guys in the weight class. And for Tsarukyan, you're right. If he was able to win that last fight out against Gamrot, and it was a really close fight, it was one of those fights that could go either way. I'm not going to sit here and tell you it was a robbery one way or another, because it was an incredible fight between those two guys. But I think we did see just what Tsarukyan can be at his best, and I think we saw that a little bit too, and I know we're going to talk about that in his debut when he took on Islam Makhachev. Like, he might not always show the full capacity of his skill set every time out there, but there's definitely been enough promise from some of his past performances for this to be a high level fight. And just to go off the co-main event from last week, like, Paddy Pimblett's a name that's really out there right now. Could he get a ranked opponent? These guys are at the bottom of the rankings in the lightweight division. That just tells you how good 155 is in the UFC. Like, you have to go through some killers to get a ranked opponent.
No offense. But both of these guys would dust them.
Oh, of course. My whole point. Like, Ismagulov's ranked, what, 12th in the division?
Yeah, both guys are ranked. And you move it forward. I mean, Said Nurmagomedov looking to hang on to his rank. He's ranked 15th in the bantamweight division, taking on Saeed Yakub Kakhramonov. I mean, this guy, what can he not do? And for Kakhramonov, you look at the fight that he brought in his UFC debut against Trevin Jones. You look at the fight that he had against Ronnie Lawrence. And you would have thought, hey, Ronnie Lawrence is a pretty good wrestler, grappler. Kakhramonov said, and he absolutely ground him out. Both of these guys have very fan-friendly styles. And if you watch Nurmagomedov's last fight that he had against Douglas Silva de Andrade, it might not have been a fight of the night. He might have got cracked a little bit, but he also landed some great spinning attacks and busted up his opponent. I think skill for skill, this is one of the best fights on the card. And it might fly under the radar because these guys might not be blood and guts type of fighters. But skill for skill, I think this is definitely a fight of the night contender.
It should be a really entertaining matchup. The problem is, one of these guys is going to kind of get killed off on the prelims. And I feel like this fight is much more deserving of a main card slot. And I'm not someone who normally gets caught up in where a fighter fights on a different card. But that's a really high-level fight. Like you said, only one of those guys is ranked. The winner of that is, of course, going to get another ranked opponent afterwards. You hope that this fight is good enough to where the loser doesn't really lose a lot of stock after all. But still, this is one of those fights where you're like, damn, if the loser is going to lose stock, it would be nice if they at least get a big spotlight on this fight. So hopefully this fight does get the respect that it deserves, because these guys are both incredibly high level, and the winner of this is definitely deserving of one of those top names at 135 pounds.
Big time opportunities, 14 total fights. Let us know down below in the comment section. You guys filled it last week, letting us know who you had in a fight of the night, and I bet nobody picked Dricus du Plessis and Darren Till to win that award, but I bet people didn't think there were going to be performance bonuses for what, 9 other fighters that were on that card.
That's great though. Every pay-per-view. I am so in favor of that. Just give out a finish bonus. I don't know why that's a big issue.
Big time card coming up this weekend. Can't wait for it. A little bit of housekeeping before we dive right into it. 14 total fights, 1 UFC debut, and a lot of fights that have fallen out on this card. And we will go through it fight by fight, but Alessandro Costa is in on short notice, taking on the ranked Amir Albazi, replacing Brandon Royval. Like, that is a big time fight for him. You've got a lot of fights that have fallen out and been thrown together. I know Cody Brundage's fight, he was supposed to take on Rodolfo Vieira a few weeks ago. Michael Husar Olaszczyk had a couple of opponents fall out. And it's going to be a different one, but Mr. David out of Czechia, he's going to be taking on Manel Kopp. That's a giant fight at flyweight. That's the second fight that's on the prelims. So again, 9 ranked fighters, a lot to get excited about on this one. And the other thing, guys, if you haven't been checking us out, Spotify and Apple Podcasts, we're out there every single week. I know YouTube gets all the shine, but if you're looking to listen in the car, on the airplane, when you're running on the treadmill, doing whatever you're doing, make sure you check us out over there. But Matt, I know you're really, really amped up about this one because it feels like a fun fight night card to kind of close out the year.
It does. There's a lot of well-matched fights. We haven't even talked about Jake Matthews, Matt Semelsberger. That's a really fun fight outside the rankings at 170 pounds. And honestly, the winner of that, maybe a ranked opponent's a little bit too far, but they're getting a fighter who was recently ranked or someone who has a very high opinion in the common MMA world. So I think that's a very high-level fight that has definitely flown under the radar.
Make sure you check us out at Fight Night Picks, Twitter, and Instagram for more. We're going to have some interesting content coming out throughout the holidays. You guys ask for it. You're going to get that tier list of MMA nicknames, 110%. Will Twinkle Toes Frank Trigg make it in the Legends category?
Not for me.
Not for you, but that is definitely an interesting one. So check us out there. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. I'm amped up. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Big time bantamweights looking to vault themselves one step closer to the rankings. We have the first of 2 M1 global champs from the past. We have Sergey Morozov representing Kazakhstan, the former bantamweight champ over there before he made his UFC debut, taking on the Pacific Northwest Journey Newsom. And for Newsom coming into the UFC, he came in on incredibly short notice, replaced Sergio Pettis to take on Ricardo Ramos. Was he favored to win that fight? Not at all. Did he win that fight? No, he didn't. But throughout Newsom's career, it's been a little bit of a roller coaster ride. And I know between his second to last fight, which was a terrible loss to Randy Costa, to his last fight out when he took on Fernie Garcia, he was out for about a year and a half. Seemed like he was rehabbing a knee injury. Came into that fight against Garcia as a slight underdog. And I thought he really did impress. He looked really good. Didn't look like there was any, you know, ring rust. I know Dominic Cruz doesn't believe in that, but we will talk about that because this is his division after all. But for Newsom, maybe it took him a little bit of time in the first round to get himself back into the fight because he was striking quite a bit from distance and he was hitting a lot of air. But in the second round, the third round, really mixed his martial arts. And that's the thing for Journey Newsom when you watch a lot of his fight tape. He will be known for all the knockouts and all the finishes that he had on the regional scene. If you go look at his no contests, losses on his UFC record. He starched Domingo Plarte, but he tested positive for the sticky icky. So in that case, to me, I look at Jurny Newsom as a guy in the UFC that's ostensibly at 2-2, but he's taking on a guy in Sergey Morozov that had all of those accolades. And I know for Morozov, he is the same age. They're both 33. But when I look at Morozov and I think of him in my mind's eye, I think, man, this guy's gritty and grimy. Like
He certainly is.
He gets in there. And so I told Matt off camera, I said, I've got an NFL comp. People at home, they might enjoy it. They went wild when you didn't know who Sean Alexander was way back when. But I'll throw another running back at you for the
fans. He was on the front of a Madden, wasn't he?
He was.
I do know who he is. Okay.
All right. So my comparison right here is Darren Sproles. And you might say, well,
I've
why?
I've never heard of him. I'm sorry.
Oh, boy. Philadelphia Eagles fans, Chargers fans, you're not going to like that. But
Jalen Hurts is good.
I mean, if you do look at it for Darren Sproles, he did win a Super Bowl there. He's a consultant since 2020. But if you look at it there, Darren Sproles, I mean, he's what? All-time, what is
you
it?
Don't
kickoff?
Even know.
No, it's kickoff return yards that he had in his career. He's also a College Football Hall of Famer. But if you look at it for him, he was a Pro Bowler in his 9th, 10th, and 11th season. And that was a big thing. He continued with the longevity of being a receiver who returned punts and kickoffs that was 5'6 in the NFL. And he could always do it. He could receive. He could also run the ball. You could put him in all different instances. And for Morozov, he's known for his takedowns. He's also known for his striking. He's known as a gritty fighter. That's where my Sproles comp is. But for Morozov, he doesn't always fight to his strengths in a lot of his fights.
No, that's the problem. I really do feel like with Morozov, he does tend to fight to the level of his competition. And I vividly remember, again, I think I brought this up in a previous video, but I really want to hammer this point home. Michael Chandler talked about Justin Gaethje when Justin Gaethje went to the UFC and not to Bellator. And he said the reason he fights in such a crazy manner is he's not confident in his own skills. He knows that, hey, if I fight with all of my technique, I might only be the 10th best fighter in the world. But if I'm a brawler, if I maybe don't show some of the weaknesses in my game, if I just go out on my shield, if you will, that might be better for my overall career than just being the natural fighter that I am. And with Morozov, you do worry that there's a little bit of that in there because he does have a very high level wrestling background. He is a grit and grind type of fighter. But the problem is, when you think about grit and grind type of fighters, I always think about Daniel Cormier. Daniel Cormier was always my favorite because he was a very effective, dirty boxer, could do a lot of damage to you up tight, but we all know how good of a wrestler he is. The thing about DC was, did he get into brawls? Not really. He would get all the way in and he would know that, hey, if I crowd the distance, my opponent won't have enough range to then really damage me. Now, yes, Gustafson hit him with a knee up the middle. John Jones hit him with some elbows. But you get the idea. For the most part, it was hard to hurt DC on the outside because he knew what he was good at and he knew what he wasn't good at. With Morozov, you do wonder about, hey, what type of a game plan is he going to have going in there with Jurny Newsom? Because I do think Morozov is a more complete fighter. I think if we stack these guys' martial arts next to each other, just skill-wise, Morozov is the more skilled fighter. But how does Morozov like to fight? He likes to box and he likes to wrestle. What is the fundamental skill set of Jurny Newsom? He's a good wrestler and he does like to box, but you bring up a good point. Newsom is a guy who will strike on the outside, but it is not an effective range for him to strike at. He isn't a big guy for the weight class. He definitely has big power if he's able to land, but he doesn't really kick much. He can threaten with his wrestling to close the distance a little bit, but the thing with Newsom is he doesn't have a high enough volume for me to really be confident that, hey, on the outside without takedowns, without knockdowns, or at least damaging strikes on the outside, it's always going to be difficult for a guy like him to go out there and win a decision.
If you do look at this matchup, and for Jurny Newsom, he will kick and he'll kick to all three levels, and he does it very well, but he hits a lot of air when he will do it. And if you look at it for Sergey Morozov, maybe he thinks about that Skilo song, and he thinks, well, I'm 5'6", I wish I was a little bit taller. And then in the second part, maybe there was just a language barrier, and he didn't think, I wish I was a baller. He just went with, I wish I was a brawler, and he just went straight for that one. But when you look at Morozov, he boxes and he wrestles. He does not kickbox in his fights. He throws no kicks. He'll throw a couple in every single fight. And it's not like he's, okay, I'm going to kick in the first round. Once I've established this leg kick, I've compromised the movement. Now I get to box and brawl. Now he just box and brawls. And he has a lot of fun with it. And against Douglas Silva de Andrade, it worked in the first round. And then as the fight went on, it worked against
him. Why would you box and brawl against that tiny Brazilian man?
It worked for me. He was a big underdog in that one. And vice versa. If you look at it for Morozov, he was a big favorite in that one. So for Morozov in the UFC, he's 1-1 as an underdog. He's 1-1 as a favorite. And that one loss as a favorite, he was a pretty big favorite, almost a 3-1 when he took on Douglas Silva de Andrade. If you look at it for Newsom, 0-1 as a favorite and 2-1 as an underdog. And I count that no contest as a win because I'm assuming you would have got paid out. They don't just have that marijuana test after the fact. But You do look at this one, Newsom's undervalued, underrated skill, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. You see that in all of his training, Impact Jiu-Jitsu, around the Sick Jitsu guys up there in the Pacific Northwest. But again, if you do look at this one, I think that Newsom has better footwork. Newsom has a good work rate from distance. If it crashes, if it comes into the wrestling, I don't see Morozov getting himself into some terribly compromising positions when it does come down to the mat. And of course, a lot of people, the Pacific Northwest connection between all of these guys, Brady Heestand taking on Josh Redinghouse, and for Sergey Morozov, 1-1 against Redinghouse, the old grudge match over there with M1 Global. So the odds in this one, the favorite, Morozov, open minus 200, minus 240 right now. Newsom on the comeback, open plus 170, plus 195. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, they are to you. Matt, I'm going to say over under 70% Morozov.
I think it'll be over.
It's whoa. 684 total votes, 93% Morozov, 83% by decision. For the 7% that have Newsom, 56% by decision. I think Morozov can get it done on the inside. I think Newsom packs big power, but like you said, he doesn't throw a ton of volume. But at the same time, Morozov makes a lot of defensive mistakes in the majority of his fights.
But this is the weird thing, and I'm going to zig on my own zag. I actually think Morozov brawls, he's going to have a really good chance to win this fight, and that's why. Newsom does like to set up a lot of his own strikes with his footwork, and he really does like to use the threat of his own takedown to then open up some of his strikes on the outside. I don't think he's going to have a lot of success wrestling Morozov. Maybe if it gets into the third round and he's able to really make Sergey push a pace for, you know, 15 consistent minutes, maybe we could see Newsom secure a submission at some point in the third round, but that's a really big if you're asking me. So shy of Newsom maybe hurting Morozov and getting that submission, or maybe hurting him early when Morozov is crashing the distance, I do like Morozov with his volume and to brawl. And I hate the fact that I'm saying a benefit to his style is the fact that he can brawl, but I do think this is one of those unique matchups where if he is able to get enough on the inside of Newsom, it's going to be hard for Newsom to then respond with his own power shots.
Big time fight between these two guys. Both of us going with Kazakhstan, Sergey Morozov to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this matchup. It's a card that's loaded with a lot of great prospects. Okay. I mean, listen, co-main event, you have Demir Ismagulov take on Armin Tsarukyan. Main event, Cannonier take on Strickland. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
You heard it right from the intro. I've been messing up this guy's name, and I've been pretty much the most excited about him in the UFC's flyweight division. I'm not talking about Angola and Portugal's own star boy, Manel Kopp. I'm talking about David Dvořák. That one is very, very difficult. I mean, Christian Dvorak plays for the Montreal Canadiens, and that one's pretty easy for me. But Dvořák is coming in here and looking to make it right. I mean, he was on an incredible 16-fight win streak up until his last fight when he took on Mateusz Nicolau, and he actually was the favorite, albeit a slight favorite, in that matchup. And I mean, you could say it was very close. You could just look at the numbers and say, hey, Dvořák, I mean, he was ahead in terms of total strikes, significant strikes. Mateusz Nicolau was able to land some really, really powerful shots. And we talked about that Nicolau fight, well, just a couple of weeks ago, because Nicolau looked amazing his last time out against Matt Schnell. But for David Dvořák, if you do go back and you do watch that second round, Nicolau throwing that right hand out there, planning, and then landing his left. And it was a cartoonish wobble there from Dvořák that ended up having him down on the mat, Nicolau up on top, and so on and so forth. But for Dvořák, if you do look at it overall, through his career with Octagon, through his career in the UFC, he's been able to beat guys by being very, very multifaceted. And if you look at his fight, like, against Jordan Espinoza, what was he able to do? Throw Jan Blachowicz-like leg kicks to compromise his opponent. If you look at his fight against Juan Camilo Ronderos, he was able to go out there and just box his ears in. Now, Ronderos is on short notice. He missed weight in that fight. But for Dvořák, if you do look at it, I mean, this guy can really get it done in a lot of different ways, so long as he's not hesitant in his approach. And he's taking on a guy in Manel Kopp that, if you look at it in the UFC, both these guys have losses to Mateusz Nicolau. For Kopp, he did lose to Pantoja in his UFC debut. And for Kopp, we know this. I mean, he's the former Ryzen Bantamweight champ. But if you look at his last two fights, they finally kind of gave him a little bit of a toss on a tee. Yeah. Took on Ode Osborne, flying knee knockout. Couldn't get the performance bonus because he missed weight. His last time out, took on Zhalgas Shumagulov. And if you just watched the first 90 seconds of that fight against Shumagulov, you might go, hey, this Shumagulov guy is pretty good. And I would say, if you look at Shumagulov's record, it doesn't tell the whole story. All those decisions, the judges, they screwed him. But for Kopp's last time out, he gets tagged a little bit, he gets back into it, and oh my God, his finishing sequence in that end of that Shumagulov fight, If they attached, like, I don't know, like, power transistors to his gloves, I think he could have powered a small city with that flurry that he landed.
He did look really good, and this is why what I'm about to say might be a bit of a hot take, but I feel like with the 4-fight sample size that we have up until this point, it is fair to say, I feel like at least I thought Manel Cobb was going to be better in his UFC tenure than the guy that we've seen so far. And I know his two losses are to two of the better fighters in the division, but his two wins are over two lesser fighters. And I know, like you said, Shumagulov, his record is deceiving if you just look at his record, but still, that was a bad stylistic matchup for Shumagulov. Manel Kopp's a good defensive wrestler, so it'd be really difficult for Shumagulov to take him down. And on the feet, Kopp does have quite a bit more power. So I respect the win, don't get me wrong, it was against a very talented opponent. But the thing with Kopp is, he was like the prince to be promised coming over to the UFC. They matched him up with Pantoja and Nicolau coming over because they had that kind of expectations for Manel Kopp. So maybe this is the fight that does get me back on his hype train. And maybe a hype train is a little bit too far to say because, like you said, he is a former champion. It's not like this is not justified whatsoever. I just feel like with Kopp, I'm still left wanting a little bit more because he has yet to beat one of those guys who is firmly entrenched into the top 15. But what you said about Dvorak is also kind of the case for Manel Kopp. And that's why this fight can go one of two ways. I think it could be fight of the night. I think we could get a very long feeling out process, especially early between these two guys, because I could see a world where David Undertaker is going for a lot of takedowns early, but Kopp is doing a very good job defending them. And if that is the case, I don't know how willing David's going to be to exchange power shots on the outside with a guy like Kopp, because we saw in his last matchup, I know Nicolau's a more varied striker than Kopp is. He's going to throw from a lot of different angles, he'll switch stances, but still, you probably don't think David's going in there thinking, hey, let's throw hammers based on the performance he had last time. But I'll be honest, I was a big David believer going into his last matchup. I was really impressed by what I had seen because of his well-roundedness. When his game is working at its highest potential, he is a good outside striker. He can get mean when he needs to get mean. He is a good grappler. The problem is, when you're one of these well-rounded fighters, it can go one of two ways. You're either so well-rounded that, hey, no matter where the fight goes, you're going to look good. But also, it can be a case of you're really well-rounded, but when you fight a specialist, you're always going to struggle in that area. I think this is a really important fight for both guys. And again, that's why I'm surprised it's so far down.
Well,
the
and for Manel Kopp, I think it's somewhat justified. Again, the hype, and then you're back down again, and now we're back on the train. But the trouble is, he was supposed to take on Suma Derji back in April. Nevada State Athletic Commission said, he had trace amounts of DHMCT Turinabol M3. You know, that pulsing action like John Jones.
Salt
so then he was supposed to take on Rogerio Bontorin in June. Bontorin was hospitalized due to the weight cut. And if you're really excited about Bontorin, you can see him fighting Yuki Matoya over with the Ryzen New Year's Eve card. I'm definitely tuning into that one. Bontorin got cut after that. So for Kopp, picking up the pieces, he gets to take on Dvorak. And if you do look at it for The Undertaker, again, a chance to right the ship. And when you do look at this one, for Manel Kopp, he was so good at offensive and defensive wrestling in the ring with Ryzen with those wrestling shoes. The one thing that's really translated well over in the UFC is the fact that if he's taking on a wrestler, low stance. If he's taking on a striker, high stance. But for Kopp, he'll switch his stances a lot, and his best strike usually is that check hook from the lead side. He can do it orthodox. He can do it southpaw. You saw that when he took on poor Zhalga Shumagulov last time out. Counter left hook, lands the right down the pipe. He's able to drop him in the first knockdown. The second knockdown was, of course, the flurry. So if you look at the odds in the matchup, the favorite is Manel Kopp, open minus 160, minus 240. For Dvorak, if you look at it, plus 140 to a plus 192. So we have a look at the topology votes, Matt. So for Dvorak, takes on Nicolau's slight favorite. Now all of a sudden he's chopped liver in this matchup because he's a pretty big underdog. But I'm going to say over-under on the fight, 75% Manel Kopp, and I feel like I set myself
low. Way over.
Yeah, way low. It is way low. 585 total votes, 82% Kopp, 74% by knockout. For the 18% that have Dvorak, 81% by decision. And I agree with that one for sure. I think if Dvorak wins, it's going to be by decision. But when you do look at this one, Dvorak, good gas tank, good volume, good leg kicks. For me making a pick on this one, though, Manel Kopp has even better leg kicks. They're thunderous from the outside. And when you look at the way that he's able to implement his power with his volume, I think Kopp can win this fight.
I agree. I think Kopp will win this matchup. The weird thing is, though, I think we could get a slow feeling out process. I really do. I can see both guys threatening with their wrestling, and that might form a bit of a stalemate because those are the exchanges that are the hardest to really judge. It's, hey, let's say Kopp gets a takedown, gets up, there's a bit of a mat return on David. David flips the position around, gets on top for a few seconds. Like, no one really won. It was just effective grappling on both parts, and I feel like we will see that side of both guys' games quite a bit in this matchup, but I do favor Kopp's power, especially on the feet, if it does does come down to that. I know Mateusz Nicolaou can hurt pretty much anyone in the division. It's not the case of, hey, I've seen Nicolaou do it, now Kopp can do it, but Kopp does have really good punching power when he is able to sit down on his shots. And with the way that David does tend to leave his head up when he throws his own kicks, I can see an opportunity for Kopp to counter with one of his hooks.
Neither one of us going with Czechia's David Dvorak. Both of us going with Starboy Menel Kopp to get a win, bringing it back to, well, just a few blocks away because he's training out of Extreme Couture for this one. Let us know down below who you have, and also let us know if this should be the co-main event, because this is a fight that is insane and buried on the prelims way too low. For more on this card, you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Originally to be a big-time matchup at welterweight between Ecuador's Michael Morales and Rinat Fakhretdinov, on 2 weeks' notice, it was announced by Marcel Dorf, December 2nd to be exact, that Pooh Bear Brian Battle would be stepping in on short notice to take on the Gladiator. And if I know anything about Vegas Golden Knights hockey, or even the Henderson Silver Knights, it's that the Gladiator usually always wins. So for Fakhretdinov, a big-time opportunity. And for both of these guys, long-time former middleweights. But listen, all of the pre-fight talk on this card is going to be around Jared Cannonier's physical transformation from heavyweight to middleweight. Brian Battle's first amateur fight in 2017, he weighed 141 pounds. He's a former heavyweight that's competing at welterweight. And for Battle, his last time out, making that move down to 170 pounds, a lot of questions about the gas tank. But a lot of questions are still going to be out there when you finish Takashi Sato, picking up a performance bonus in the first minute with that head kick. So Battle looked amazing his last time out. But for Fakhretdinov, a guy that spent so long at middleweight, his last time out, he's making his UFC debut against Andreas Mihailidis. He pushed a pace. He looked really good at welterweight, didn't you think?
He did look really good, and I was worried about how the weight cut was going to affect him. But like you said, we both kind of had those question marks surrounding both these athletes in their last fights. And the weird thing about Brian Battle is, I just want to focus on him for a second. I was really surprised to see he was able to make weight against Takashi Sato. I'm not going to make that a secret whatsoever. I did not think he was going to be able to make the 170 effectively and be able to compete really well at that weight class. And like you said, the question marks are still going to be out there surrounding his gas tank, because the fight was over so quick against Sato, and Sato wasn't really in his prime, let's be honest. Like, there was a better version of him in the past, and I think that is fair to say, but Battle did answer a lot of those questions that I had, at least going into that matchup. And the thing that I want to say about Battle is, I hope he never falls in love with his power at this weight class, because that's the thing that I think Battle's going to have over a lot of fighters in the welterweight division. He is a good striker, he's a very rangy striker, he has tremendous power in the welterweight division, but the problem is, you'd hate for him to ever really fall in love with it and try to sit down on his shots, because even go back and watch the head kick he was able to land on Sato. Is there a windup on that head kick? Not really. He just throws the technique and then power comes naturally. It's like what they said about Aaron Judge for so many years. Don't try to hit home runs and the home runs will come because you naturally have that power. It was nice to see that Battle at least resembled the fighter that we had seen at 185. But the thing is, and I've got to say this based on the last Ultimate Fighter we have, I have to throw up so many red flags anytime we have Ultimate Fighter fighters in the UFC at this point, just because you never really know what you're going to get until you do have a 3, 4, 5 fight sample size. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, I do like the wins that Battle did have on the show, though. I mean, you beat Andre Petrosky. He's looked great in the UFC. You beat a guy like Gilbert Urbina, who's in there, who's down there, who's got that dog in him. But if you look at it for Battle, I mean, he beats Trayshawn Gore, monkey off your back, so to speak, when you're looking at, hey, Trayshawn Gore was supposed to be the champ. Battle's able to get the win, and then he gets the win over Takashi Sato. And for Rinat Fakhretdinov, he was 20-2 coming into the UFC, and then he was 18-1, and now he's 19-1. His record's kind of switched around, but what we do know out of Rinat Fakhretdinov is the fact that he is a former GFC champ over there, the kind of Khabib promotion before it kind of merged with Eagles FC. And if you look at it for Rinat, he was the champ. He beat Alberto Uda, who fought in the UFC, who was 0-2, but out of that, the quotable, "I don't fight against my brothers due to religious beliefs. They are Muslim, and I don't fight against my brothers." So he relinquished his belt there, took a lot of time off, fought Eric Spicely on that UAE Warriors card. And while Salt Bay was there salting stuff up, and Khabib and Dana, they were having the meeting behind closed doors, and we're going to try and get him back. Out of all of that, Rinat gets the win. But then he takes over a year off and makes his UFC debut against Mihailidis. And for his troubles, I mean, he did look really good. You do know him for the fact that he is good with the takedowns. He's going to have that over most of the guys that he takes on. But his striking is really wild, and it's not good. It's looping, it's heavy, He leaves himself out there to be countered.
Can I be fair, though? I feel like saying it's not good is a bit of an exaggeration. You're right, it is wild, but it has been effective up until this point in his career. Like, when he does land, it is devastating. So, I don't know if I'd say it's bad. It is very wild, but when he's able to land shots, he knocked out Eric Spicely with one punch and just sent him flying. Eric Spicely is a big guy who has fought some really good fighters in the UFC, beat Thiago Santos by a rear naked choke. I'm just saying, I don't think you can just say Fakhretdinov's a bad striker because he is unorthodox with his strike.
And if you do look at it for Fakhretdinov, his background's a combat Sambo and Pankration, you know, just slapping guys down. Boss Rutten would absolutely love this fighter if we ever had him on commentary in the UFC, but if you look at the odds in the matchup, they don't really have any. So again, this fight was made on 2 weeks notice, so I'll have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to add in this little bit of, information. Rinat Fakhretdinov had a giant following outside of the UFC, and I'm assuming the fans are going to go with him in this one. I'm going to say over under 72.5% for the Gladiator here.
I think they'll be under.
I think they're going to be under. They're under, and they actually favor Battle. I feel like you looked these up beforehand. No. 482 total votes, 56% Battle, 64% by decision for the 44% that have Fakhretdinov, 76% by decision. We didn't actually talk about their fighting styles all that much before we went with the votes. So
I said Brian Battle's a natural striker, Fakhretdinov's a wild. Like, that's my big issue with this matchup. If Fakhretdinov's not able to get consistent takedowns, I do think he's going to leave himself open at a certain point on the feet. And the question mark with Battle is, he doesn't have great volume, he doesn't have great knockout power, even though I spent a large majority of the early part of this video stating how good his knockout power is. I think it will translate down to 170 pounds because of how big of an athlete he is. But again, he's not someone who's really going to wow you with how busy he is in the octagon. So maybe if Fakhretdinov is able to get 2, 3, 4 takedowns, that could be enough to negate some of the good work Brian Battle's able to do on the feet. I just think for me, and the reason why I said under for the votes is, since we don't have odds, if you were to ask me where would I put the odds in this matchup, honestly, I think Battle's going to be like a minus 155.
I think Fakhretdinov is going to be like a minus 200. Seriously.
That's fair. I just think with Fakhretdinov and his style, he leaves himself so wide open for a striker like Brian Battle. And again, I'm not saying Battle's going to knock him out. I think that's a very difficult prediction to make. Oh, this guy's going to stop the other, but I just think styles make fights, to quote the great Mike Goldberg, and the way Fakhretdinov leaves himself open, I think Brian Battle is the type of striker who can exploit some of that. And the thing I want to mention too is Brian Battle throws great knees at the middle, throws really good attacks at the middle. Those are things that are going to land if Fakhretdinov's throwing those big looping shots.
And Battle was a big favorite his last time out against Takashi Sato, and so was Fakhretdinov. So Battle was a minus 300 against Sato, Fakhretdinov minus 280 against Mikhailidis. Both guys had really good showings for Fakhretdinov. Two judges scored at 30-26, 130-27, but he was able to ground out Mikhailidis. He did get hit by spinning wheel kick, and then he kind of dropped down into a takedown off of it because Mikhailidis fell down. He looked over at his corner, and he gave him the wink, which was really crazy, and if I could show footage, I would show it here. I know everybody wishes we could, but this isn't Major League Baseball, or this isn't the NBA. But when it does come down to this matchup, I favor Brian Battle, and for the X factor that is, he has lights out jiu-jitsu too. And when you consider it against a guy like Fakhretdinov, I think sweeps are going to be available to him. And I think he's going to be able to implement and at least threaten with some of his jiu-jitsu. So I think for the complete package, I'll go with Battle. But if Fakhretdinov open is a big favorite, in my mind, it wouldn't surprise me. So both of us going with Pooh Bear Brian Battle to get the win in the matchup. Let us know down below. I know there's so many Gladiator Fakhretdinov fans that you're going to be down there in the comment section. Let us know who you have at the top of this card. Cannoneer versus Strickland. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, 23-year-old Chinese striking sensation Heiser Mahashata is going to be taking on the second Garcia in as many UFC fights to kick off his UFC career, taking on gifted Rafa Garcia, the former Combate lightweight champ. And for Garcia, 2-3 in the UFC so far, but he's taken on a very high level of competition. Definitely. There's a lot thought out of him. Of course, he trains out of pound for pound Muay Thai. He trains out of Onyx Labs. He trains out of the big gyms in Colorado, but also trains with Cub Swanson and Rukus Sport when he's down in California. So a lot known out of Garcia, but for Mahashata, we had a lot of great things to say about him in his UFC debut. We had a lot of red flags. We're going to throw it on back. We don't do this very often, but to that original UFC prediction, and then offer up some thoughts on his UFC debut when he took on Steve Garcia. People in the know are very excited about 22-year-old Chinese phenom Mahashata making his UFC debut He main evented the season finale of last year's season, number 5, Dana White's Contender Series, getting a win over a Canadian with one of the most interesting names you've ever heard. It was Achilles, and I want to make sure that I get this one right, Estra Morada, and in that one, the Canadian former BTC lightweight champ from Vancouver, BC, was a giant favorite. I mean, Mahashata in that fight was plus 475 underdog in that fight. And listen, at the start of it, you kind of get Mahashata making his walk in. Laura Sanko's narrating it going, hey, Michael Bisping and I had a hard time finding any fight tape on this fight. And I took that like Isaiah Thomas talking about Michael Jordan not getting on the Dream Team. And I took that personally. So I went out there, and this is what you need to do. Can't find the fight tape? Go on Mahashata's Topology page. Take the Chinese characters next to his name. You put those into Google, and you go into the weird corners of the Chinese network of the internet, and you find the fight tape of Mahashata. It is out there. But Matt, what I do have to say about this is, this guy, for being a 22-year-old prospect, is a very polished striker. And that's what I absolutely love out of his game. He's going to meet fire with fire coming up this weekend. Take on Mean Machine Steve Garcia, a guy who finished Charlie Ontiveros in his last fight and lost in his UFC debut. And a guy who's fought a level of competition outside of the UFC coming in, but a guy who probably not like top of mind, tip of the tongue for a lot of UFC fans, is Mean Machine Steve Garcia. So Matt, for Heiser Mahashata, probably a good piece of matchmaking, I guess, giving him Garcia. I don't have the highest hopes out of this fight, but Mahashata had a hell of a first round his last time out against old Achilles Estra Morata. And in that fight, I'm surprised he didn't get finished at multiple instances.
And let's think about both of these guys. They're both hittable. And I do think that it will be a very entertaining fight. That's the thing. Both guys' styles will cater towards each other. I do think they're both hittable enough to where they'll meet each other in the middle of the ring. And honestly, not that whoever lands first is going to win, but whoever wins that first exchange, you'll probably be able to figure out how the rest of the fight's going to go. Because I do think Mahashata is the much faster striker on the feet. I do think he has better accuracy. He at least throws these straighter shots. But if Garcia can use his physicality and try to bully him up against the cage, I could expect Garcia to have a lot more success in some of those areas.
All right, so it happens to be that Mahashata might have the most laser-like right hand, right cross I've ever seen. He dropped Garcia twice. First time, wobbled him. Second time, face planted him. He picked up a performance bonus in his UFC debut. Were questions answered for you, Matt, in Mahashata's debut against Garcia?
Some of them were, but I still feel like it's appropriate to have further questions about him because...
The one thing, too, like, he was a big underdog. We talked about that on Contender Series. Also a pretty big underdog when he took on Garcia there in that UFC debut.
He was, but knowing what we know now, I don't think Steve Garcia was the highest-rated fighter of all time, and he definitely doesn't have the best striking defense in the world. But the good thing is, we now know what Mahashata can build upon on his skill set. We know what he's good at least. He's got insane power and really good striking speed, and that's going to be really important in this matchup against Rafa Garcia. Because, yes, the Garcias are very different between his two fights, but Rafa Garcia's got that grit and grind to him. I know you hate it, he got that dog in him, but still, if Mahashata does struggle with pressure, if he does struggle with decision-making on the fly, be it with defending the takedown or defending big strikes coming, Rafa Garcia is the type of opponent who is going to start to at least ask you those questions in the cage, and those are the types of opponents that you want these prospects to face, because let's say Mahashata is a more improved prospect in the other areas of his game, not just his striking. Let's say he does have the offensive wrestling. His takedown defense is getting better. You get the idea. Then I genuinely do think he's a prospect you can get excited about. He's very young in his career. And the thing that I always say about fighters is really up until they reach 25, 26 is they're going to get better every single time you see them out there. And what's the deal with a lot of MMA fighters? They played football until they were in college. They played basketball or hockey, or they did something else until they then went into MMA. So they haven't really done their whole entire life, unless you have like an Adesanya or a Pereira, you know, these people who have these very high level backgrounds. A lot of MMA fighters are transitioning into the sport, and now that they have a lot more focus on it and that's what they're doing, they're going to get better. And I think for Mahashata, the skill set that he showed in his debut is one that you can get excited about, because let's say he is able to add the high level footwork that goes along with it, the feints that can then accentuate some of his own strikes, I think he will be able to start to move up this division. But the thing about the lightweight division is, and we say this every single week, you gotta win what, 7 fights, 8 fights, 9 fights if you ever want to get a ranked opponent. So for Mahashata, I really did like what we saw the last time out of Steve Garcia. The thing is, though, even like what we said with Brian Battle knocking out Takashi Sato, getting these early wins is great, getting these stoppage wins is great, but it's still going to leave a lot more questions.
Both of these guys are super hittable, like incredibly hittable. And Mahashata, for as many great things as we said about him, you know, after his last fight, Steve Garcia landed clean on him before Mahashata was able to throw that right hand out there. And for him, you look at it, you're training at all these different gyms. We've seen him kill Cliff FC with Shayulan Nordumbeka, who got that win over Derek Minner a while ago. And for Mahashata, he's also training out of Bali MMA, so an interesting move there out of Indonesia. But for Rafa Garcia, I went on to Nate Latshaw's website, because you always see him out there on Twitter, and he's got all those statistical percentages. For Garcia, five-fight sample in the UFC, short-notice UFC debut when he did come in against, it was Nasrat Haqparast. He is spending 67% of his time striking at distance. -1.94 strike differential per minute at distance. So Rafa Garcia, he's got to close the distance, get in close, get the takedown. We saw that against Jesse Ronson in that fight. Looked amazing in that one. His other UFC win over Natan Levy, where he was just able to grind him out, close the distance against a kickboxer, make it grimy and gritty. For Garcia, the loss in the UFC, Haqparast, where, again, it was all at distance and he couldn't figure it out. Chris Gritzmacher, he just about 10-8ed him in the first round, had no gas left in the tank, round two, round three. And then his last time out, he takes on Jakar Close, grimy type of fight. And he wasn't able to get it done in that one. But Mahashata is not Jakar Close, and Rafa Garcia is not Steve Garcia. So when it does come down to this one, Garcia himself, 1-1 as a favorite in the UFC, 1-2 as the underdog. When we look at this one, in terms of the odds, they open up par. Garcia, slight favorite, -120. Mahashata at a -100. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprised us, they are to you. I haven't been good at setting the bar, but I'm going to assume that the fans have Rafa Garcia. I'm going to say over under 65% Garcia.
I think it'll be close to 50-50. I'll say under.
You're going to say under? It's oh my God. Wow. 629 total votes.
Further than I thought, to be fair.
75% Mahashata, 58% by decision, 35% by knockout. For the 25% that have Garcia, 77% by decision. I can't even guess what these fans are thinking about these fights.
I do think this is a difficult fight to predict, though, if I'm being honest. Like, I can't fault anybody for giving an independent opinion on this fight, if that makes any sense. Like, if you came up to me and said Mahashata's going to win via decision, sure, I'm not going to disagree with that. If he's going to win by first, second, or third round knockout, I can agree with all those outcomes, too. But you also have to admit that the same can be true for Rafa Garcia. I agree wholeheartedly with what you said. Both these men are extremely hittable, but I think it's going to result in a very fun fight. Like, I don't think this is going to be boring, but any stretch of the imagination, it's one of the more non-heavyweight fights you will ever get. I think it's going to be difficult, though, because the thing about Mahashata is he likes to fight at his own pace. When he's the one moving forward, he is really good being the one dictating the pace. I think Rafa Garcia is going to try to move forward a lot, at least in the early goings of this fight, but it will be interesting to see. If Garcia's not able to judge that distance early, he might just not have any answer at range. That was the one big problem he had against Nasrat Haqparast, like you said. I know it's a very high-level opponent. It's on short notice, but still, Nasrat Haqparast doesn't do anything that's really going to wow you. Like, yes, he has good hand speed. He's a good boxer, but he's not some guy who's going to throw spinning wheel kicks. He's not going to do anything that's really unorthodox by any means. Mahashata isn't as good as Nasrat Haqparast, but he is going to offer a lot of the same kind of bare bones of his game. I think it's going to be a really fun one. I've been milking my pick for as long as I can because it's a really difficult fight to pick. I think ever so slightly, I'm going to say Rafa Garcia. I do worry about him eating one of those big shots very early on, but still, I think he's going to be able to threaten with his own wrestling a little bit more, and let's say he is able to hit Mahashata and get his respect on the feet. I think that's going to open up his own grappling game.
Well, I mean, for Garcia, he also has a training partner that's fighting on this card further up the card. Drew Dober, who's taking on Bobby Green, so make sure you check that one out. That's a possible fight of the night as well. But for Garcia, high boxing stance kind of negates a lot of the attacks from Mahashata, and if he's able to mix in some of the grappling, we saw that on Contender Series. Estremadura is what his name is. I mispronounced it in all of that video, but Estremadura, Achilles Estremadura, the Canadian, he wasn't able to get it going. He was able to really land on Mahashata. And again, Mahashata was a big underdog in that fight. Dana White liked the youth out of it. And if Mahashata wins this one, who knows? Will he give a shout out back home to his mom? Is he going to give the bonus to her to buy a minivan to drive him to the PI?
I brought this up on Question Mark Kicks. Jay Perrin woke up and decided to beef with an 18-year-old. And now he lost to him by first round stop.
He was very complimentary after the
fight.
We'll see how it works out for Garcia. I'm going to edge the experience in this one. But if you go with Mahashata, I'm here to listen to your argument. A great fight that is featured on this card at lightweight. We get a battle outside of the rankings. Up at the top, middleweights that really are contending. We have Sean Strickland taking on Jared Cannonier. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. The rankings are in play at Bantamweight. Coming up this weekend, Said Yakub Cockrockmonov is... he's knock, knock, knocking on that door. And you know what? I just ruined the night for my two dogs out there. They're fired up. And some guy named Kyle's probably sitting on his couch just absolutely wondering what the hell's going on and who wants his business. But when it comes down to this fight, that was all by design. Kakhramonov really has a good chance to wake people up and get them excited about this fight. And for Saeed Nurmagomedov, ranked 15th, he's got to hold on to that against an unranked fighter. And you'd think for a guy like Nurmagomedov, he's been on a lot of people's radar since even before he made his UFC debut. He's a WFCA bantamweight champ. He came in, he took on Scoggins, and he won by split decision. And then he came in and took on Ricardo Ramos, an underdog. And he won that fight, and he spun his way into that one. Now, he did lose to Hani Barcelos. He came back. He's won three straight. But for Nurmagomedov, all of the things that led him to people enjoying him as a fan favorite, he was able to bring into his last couple of performances. Cody Stamann, performance bonus. Hey, Cody, you were ranked for a while. Hey, Cody, going to submit you very quickly out of Wrestling Exchange. And his last time out against Douglas Silva, D'Andrage, the pocket rocket. Matt, I know D. Silva was able to rock him. I even thought he knocked down Nurmagomedov out of one of the exchanges. But Nurmagomedov, for what it was worth, brought in a complete skill set and really did look good that last time out.
He did, and Nurmagomedov feels more dangerous at this stage of his career. It's not that his skill set's really changed all that much, but does feel like he's been able to dial up his aggression. Maybe not tenfold, but you get the idea. He is much more likely to end the fight via submission, via maybe TKO is a bit of a stretch. He's not the most damaging striker in the world. He's a very technical striker, but he doesn't really leave guys exiting exchanges really cut up. Like, remember Trinkus Duplessis last weekend against Darren Till? They looked like rabbit shots, especially in that first round, but then Darren Till walked back to his corner, and even watching the fight, saying like, ooh, I don't really agree with the ref kind of being in there, but when Darren Till went back to his corner, his eye was quite damaged, and Nurmagomedov's not one of these guys who's gonna hit you three or four times and leave you broken and bruised. But again, like I said, he's very technical on the outside. And the thing that I always want to bring up about Nurmagomedov is you look at his last name and it is very deceiving. You assume he's going to go out there, attack with high single legs, threaten with chain wrestling, get on top of his opponent, and really ground and pound them into a pulp. And can he do that? Yes, he can. But when Nurmagomedov is at his best, it's on the outside, using his kicks, using his very high level footwork. And that's the thing I do like out of Nurmagomedov. A lot of wrestlers from kind of the Russian country, they like to pressure with their own pressure, with their own footwork. Nurmagomedov's fine with you bringing the fight to him, which isn't something we often see from a fighter with his style, but like you had mentioned, it's opened up submissions when his opponents try to crash forward and then open up his grappling. I just really like how his skill set complements itself.
And it could work really well for him, and if he kind of draws off that last name, Saeed Kakhramonov became on my radar, popped up, struggle with that one, because of his fight against Umar Nurmagomedov. It was that PFL showcase fight, and that was the best fight anybody's ever had against Umar Nurmagomedov. Oh, yeah. UFC or otherwise, Kakhramonov was able to take him down in that fight. The kicks and the pressure won it for Umar, but it was a very, very close fight. And for Saeed Nurmagomedov, if you do look at it, he's not related to Khabib or Umar, but he does come from the same region of the world. The thing that you like in the UFC is the fact that he has a positive 1.95 strike differential, 70% takedown defense. Barcelos was able to get two against them, and then D-Sil was able to get one. But in the second round of that fight, as Saeed Nurmagomedov was a minus 460 favorite against Barcelos, against De Silva. De Silva landed a spinning back fist that dropped Nurmagomedov, and then he got on top of him. It's not counted on a score sheet, but if you go back and watch the fight, it definitely was one. And if you do look at it for both these guys, you might think, hey, like, they're on the underground. 116,000 Instagram followers for Nurmagomedov, 55.6 for Kakhramonov. You're doing something right. For Kakhramonov, you do look at it, his background is Sambo, as a guy that's built out of Uzbekistan, but growing up in the States, he's training out of the Pacific Northwest and California, so we'll just call it the whole Pacific Coast. But if you look at it, for Kakhramonov, trains out of Warrior Camp with Terrence McKinney, pretty heck of a fighter in the UFC. But for Kakhramonov, claim to fame, 2019, the FIAS Sambo Championships. Number one was a guy by the name of Stepan Kobanov, who beat number two, Mrab Dwashvili. But third and fourth, you have Yurlan Makhmudov and then Saidyakub Kakhramonov. For Kakhramonov, came in on short notice, incredibly short notice, against Trevin Jones. He weighed 138.5, so it was a bit of a blemish. But very, very late, with about 15 seconds left, he submitted Jones.
He looked good.
And he looked really good. His cardio was on point. His last time out, took on Ronnie Lawrence. And he came in, you thought, hey, Lawrence is good at chaining takedowns together. Oh my gosh, 10 of 16 attempt for Cock Rachmanov with those takedowns, 12 minutes and 19 seconds of control time, 230-27s, 130-26. Cock Rachmanov looked amazing against fighters he thought might be able to stall him out in the UFC.
This is where I'm going to zag a little bit. The thing about Cock Rachmanov is I think he does excel at fighting fighters who don't have trouble finding him. Guys who do like to go forward and guys who make their presence known. When you pressure Cock Rachmanov, he's a good counter striker. He has really good defensive submissions too. I don't know if this is the matchup where he's really going to be able to take advantage of some of those skill sets, because Nurmagomedov's going to be happy to wait on the outside and make Saeed Yacoub go to him. And that's why I think this fight's going to be very interesting, because whoever's moving forward is probably going to have more success. But like I mentioned, the unique thing about Nurmagomedov is he doesn't mind being pressured. And a lot of guys who do have his grappling kind of a style, because when he gets on top of guys, it might not be lights out, but like, he cuts through your guard, he gets past it. And that's what I like out of Saeed Nurmagomedov. He's not someone who will lay and pray. He will go for that finish. And we have seen him take up his aggression as of late. But like we've said, and we fed this horse until it died, this is one of the best fights in the card. I don't know how anybody could argue against that. The winner of this is extremely deserving of anybody in the top five, if I'm being completely honest.
No.
I just think in the bantamweight division, the top 10 is very deep.
The winner of this fight doesn't even fight Marlon Vera.
No, Marlon Vera, but Marlon Vera is what, like number four, number five?
Yeah,
number
like three? you're, it's a really, that's a stretch.
Okay, maybe not, but I do feel like they deserve to fight up in the rankings without a doubt. They deserve an opponent with a number next to their name. Maybe top five is a little bit too high, I admit, but again, you do expect big things out of both these guys, and that's why I said this fight should be main card. They both have a lot to lose.
Cock Rachmanov's been an underdog in both his UFC fights, and Nurmagomedov, again, was a minus 460 favorite against D. Silva's last time out. In this one, Nurmagomedov open minus 150, he's minus 120. 20, Cock Rachmanov open plus 130, minus 104. We have a look at the votes over on Topology. Now, this is where I think the fans and all of us, I don't anticipate this one's going to be close to the fans. I'm going to say over under 70% Nurmagomedov.
It'll be over, but I hope it's under. I'll say under.
It's over. So 681 total votes, 80% Nurmagomedov, 71% by decision. For the 20% that have Cock Rachmanov, 83% by decision. From Cock Rachmanov's fight against Umar Nurmagomedov when he was 22 in the PFL to now, he's just gotten better at what he was already good at. And he was a really skilled fighter at 22. And for Nurmagomedov, again, same thing. Has he had this huge uptick in his volume? No. But he's added to picking his power shots, and he's also added to those defensive things. And if you look at his fight against Mark Striegel, who, again, if Cock Rachmanov fought Mark Striegel, I think he would also win that fight. But Nurmagomedov, anticipating the takedowns and being just vicious with his finish, he could really play off of that in a fight like this against Cock Rachmanov.
And that's what I think. I do think Nurmagomedov's going to have more success in the grappling between these two. Now, on the feet, I don't expect a finish, and that's why I do have a very hard time predicting this fight, because I know we have it on the fight of the night screen too. I think it's a very skilled fight. I think there's a world where this isn't a good fight. I'm going to say this right now. I think there's a world where both guys stay on the outside, respect their opponent's skill set, and just say, hey, I'm kind of good with having a low volume outside fight, and we'll see what happens by the end of it. That might not be a popular prediction, and I hope that's not what we get, but I can see a world, because both these guys are so skilled, that it's, hey, they get into one grappling exchange, it's like, okay, ooh, that guy's pretty dangerous, and then they both stay away from each other. I can see a world where that happens. I will say, though, I do like Saeed Nurmagomedov in this matchup. I was very impressed by his submission win over Cody Stamann, I must say. Cody Stamann is not just a good grappler. That man's a great grappler. He can go out there and wrestle. He is good at jiu-jitsu. He has a very strong camp, too, where he primarily does train his grappling. And for those reasons, I do like Nurmagomedov in this matchup, but I can't say this enough times. This is arguably the most skilled fight on the whole entire card, and I'm very excited to watch it.
I spent both Cock Rachmanov fights when he took on Jones and when he took on Ronnie Lawrence, and I thought about it, and then I went back and watched it just for the hell of it. And all I did in the entire video was compliment Cock Rachmanov and not pick him in the fight. And I'm doing it again this week, and I hate it. Because I love Saeed Yacoub Cock Rachmanov, and I don't want to discredit any of his skills. I just think that Nurmagomedov has a lot of the counters to it. So if you like Cock Rachmanov, I love him as a fighter. It pains me not to pick him in this fight. I'm going Nurmagomedov. Both of us are. But let us know down below in the comment section, please, who you have in this fight. It's super high level. It's really hard to try and actually make a prediction, and it's a lot more fun to make a preview in this one. But let us know who you have in this fight. We have a lot of very, very good, well put together fights that are on this card that's at the UFC's Apex. So keep it locked in with Fight in Apex. We always say, let's get into it. It's been a while. It's something that Aaron Lewis said big time in 2001, but it's been a while since I've said this, Matt. It's a Weird Buck and a Muscles type of fight. Coming up this weekend, it's more, if you don't know Weird Buck and a Muscles and you're not a Fight Night Picks fan, it's more like that clip from Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. But why? But why is this a fight in the UFC? We have it in the middleweight division. A couple of guys that...
Because who else are they going to fight? If I may, Julian Marquez and Deron Wynn are two guys that at one point had decently high expectations associated with them. Julian Marquez was one of the early standouts from Contender Series, a show that is still heavily pushed to this day. You realize just how many of their prospects are in the UFC, but Julian Marquez is one of the few who grabbed that mic, and it was before it was, hey, be Joe Pyfer. It was basically, hey, be Julian Marquez, have an entertaining fighting style, absorb punches to give your own, and be good on the mic. And if you can accept those three things, you're going to make it far. And to Marquez's credit, he got his UFC career off to a really good start. A lot of us will remember, because that fight was a long time ago now. He had that debut against Darren Stewart. It was back and forth. He had some really big shots in that matchup, but he was able to ultimately win by submission, and I feel like it did set the stage for what we're going to see from Julian Marquez throughout the rest of his career. Does he really excel in any one area? Probably not. I'd say he's
striking.
But the thing is, on the feet, he gets hit like it's going out of style. So it's hard to say he excels with his striking. I just think for Marquez, he's a guy who's very tough, and he does have decent cardio. And it just depends on how far that can take
him. Well, and for Julian Marquez, last time out, went shot for shot with Gregory Rodriguez's last time out. He got dropped by a straight left. He got dropped by a right uppercut. He got dropped by a right hook. And the third knockdown was kind of a wobble, and then he kind of got back up. But the fourth one wasn't. He got hit by a right cross. So I counted four knockdowns. The UFC considered Gregory Rodriguez as landing three. But regardless, performance bonus for Gregory and up close to the rankings. For Marquez, he got brutalized his last time out. For Deron Wynn, I mean, he got brutalized his last time out. And he only got dropped once, but a lot of people wanted the fight to be stopped standing because he got absolutely lit up by Phil Haas in his last fight. And for Deron Wynn, he came into the UFC off a win over Ultimate Fighter 8. contestant Filthy Tom Lawler over at Liddell Ortiz 3. You know that from Oscar De La Hoya's foray into MMA. And if you look at it, Deron Wynn at that time was 5'8 and 205.6 pounds. And the UFC went, Red Rover, send that fellow over. And so they did. And he took on Eric Spicely. And in that fight, Deron Wynn threw 169 significant strikes. That's a middleweight division record. But since then, we haven't seen the same level of striking from Deron Wynn.
He really has left us wanting more. And that's the thing about Wynn. They're going to talk about his wrestling background. He is a very talented wrestler. But the problem is, he doesn't have good striking defense whatsoever on the feet. And that has to be said for both guys. And that's really the thing, honestly. Like, whoever's the most aggressive is probably going to win this fight, if I'm being completely honest with you. Neither guy has bad chins, and I think that has to be said. It's not like weak shots to put Marquez down and weak shots to put Deron Wynn down. It's like decently heavy power punches hitting them with really big shots. But that's why both guys kind of play into each other's styles. Wynn could go in there and shoot for the 55 takedowns he did against Antonio Ahoyo.
12 in that fight.
He shot for a lot of takedowns, so you get the idea. Awful fight. I do not recommend going back and watching it. But the thing about Wynn has always been, physically he doesn't fit into this weight class. And that's a weird thing to say because he has missed weight in the middleweight division. But when Daniel Cormier, his own good friend and training partner, has openly said on commentary, we want to get him down to welterweight. We think he can fight at 170. In what world can Deron Wynn fight at 170?
Well, and that's a...
It just, physically, he doesn't fit into this weight class whatsoever. And for Julian Marquez, I'm not here to tell you, hey, he DM'd Miley Cyrus that one time. He's got to be good at fighting. But the thing about Marquez is he small for the weight class? Not at all. Does he push a pace? Yes, he does. And the thing about Wynn that I didn't like in the Gerald Meerschaert fight is, and I know we both like Gerald Meerschaert compared to the average person. We are higher on him than the average person might be. But Wynn doesn't react well to pressure whatsoever. When guys really do pressure him and he's not able to get his own takedowns, he doesn't have a lot in terms of answers on the feet other than winging some big power shots. And yes, maybe one of those could land on Marquez, but I do think Marquez is the steadier striker in this matchup. So I think if the fight is contested on the feet, then I do like Marquez in the striking. But I think Wynn could fight one of those grindy wrestling type of a fights. It's not going to be an aesthetically pleasing one.
And that's the awkward thing about the fight. For Deron Wynn and for Julian Marquez, MMA math, if you play it out, Julian Marquez wins 100%. I mean, he beat Phil Haas. Wynn just lost to Phil Haas. He beat Darren Stewart. Julian Marquez did. Wynn lost to Darren Stewart. So 2-0, and automatically Julian Marquez gets the win. I'm eager to see who Julian Marquez has in his corner. because he's been training in Kansas City for a long time, or Kansas City area. And I know he had Johnny Eblen in his training camp. He had that on his Instagram. But really eager to see, because he used to be billed out of Extreme Couture, but it hasn't been so for a very long time. In his last fight, when he took on Gregory Rodriguez earlier on this summer, James Krause was in his corner. So we'll see how that plays out for Julian Marquez. But in this matchup, Marquez, 100% finish rate in the UFC, or as a pro also. And I put for his style in this one because I decided to change the graphics up. For Deron Winnis Wrestling, for Julian Marquez, I put grit. That's his style. He's a grit fighter. And I didn't think anybody would disagree on that one. I think even Julian Marquez would say I'm pretty gritty too.
Does Deron Winn leave his neck open on takedown attempts? Do bears shit in the woods? Is the sky blue? Yes, all of those things are true.
But he doesn't have a big neck.
He's definitely susceptible to submissions. Gerald Meerschaert submitted him. Julian Marquez is really talented at defensive submissions. That's all I'm trying to say. And I could see a world where if Wynn's going for a lot of takedowns, Nick Lentz had one of my favorite quotes. And a weird guy to think about when I think about submissions and defensive submissions. But he brought up the fact that him and Will Brooks used to train together years ago. And he said, hey, I know Will Brooks is a wrestler. I know the type of takedowns he likes to go for. So I'm going to let him take me down. And maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, but you get the idea. Every takedown he gets on me without a finish is just another opportunity. And I might not get it this time. I might not get it next time. It's like Brandon Moreno's great quote. It might not be tomorrow. It might not be next week. But eventually you'll get to where your goals are. Brandon Moreno, very inspiring figure. My point is, with Marquez and with the style that Deron Winn wrestles with, Winn goes for a heavy amount of takedowns, doesn't do a lot of damage with ground and pound, and doesn't threaten with a lot of submissions. I think that will give Julian Marquez a lot of opportunities. I'm not saying he's going to win by submission, but I think those opportunities are going to be there for Marquez to at least threaten with a lot of submissions.
Well, it really will be an interesting fight and a lot of question marks surrounding it. Marquez, the slight favorite in this one, -165, +135 for Deron Winn. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 75% for the Cuban Missile Crisis.
I think they'll be under.
You think they're going to be under? They're way over. Wow. 702 total votes. You guys are, like, I don't say this, it's not a part of my vernacular, but you guys are wilding out over there on the Tapology votes. 93% Julian Marquez, 61% by knockout, 18% by submission. For the 7% that have won, 61% by decision. Julian Marquez is more of a Swiss Army knife in the matchup, and he's also quite a bit bigger. I think Julian Marquez has more methods to win. I will pick him to win. But again, Deron Winn taking on Antonio Arroyo. Everybody's looked for Thiago Santos. Antonio Arroyo took him down 12 times, took down Darren Stewart 6 times. We'll see if Wynn's able to implement the takedowns against Marquez, because we've seen Marquez, he could sweep off his back even when he's tired, which is weird. I mean, go back to his fight against Sam Alvey if you want just a Jim Ross slobber knocker, if there ever was one. That was actually a fight of the night. He had a performance of the night bonus against Maki Pitolo. I'm going with Marquez because I've seen more methods to win. Would Deron Winn winning surprise me? A little bit.
Yeah, the winner gets another one. The loser, you kind of have to question what their future is in the organization. You hate to say that, but just the truth. Like, for Winn, like you said, came off that Liddell Ortiz card, had a little bit of hype associated with him. Nothing major, of course.
Fight of the night in his debut against Eric Spicer.
Not that he was ever like a Sean O'Malley level star or anything like that, but again, Deron Winn was more well known than your average unranked contender who just had one fight in the organization. There you go. That's such a baseball stat, it's not even funny. But I agree with you. I do think Julian Marquez has more methods to victory. Am I 93% on board Julian Marquez, though? Not at all, because he is the type of fighter who does fight to the level of his competition. Is he going to look maybe better than you'd expect against some good fighters? Probably, just because he's going to get in there and brawl. But is he going to look a little bit worse than you probably expect against guys who are just coming into the UFC? I think that's also true. So I do like Julian Marquez because, like you said, he's the more well-rounded. But I think this is a fun fight. Is this going to be a great fight? Is this the most technical fight in the world? Probably not, but I think it will be a fun one.
It's the definition of a pop and popcorn fight with Fight Night Picks and odd bucket of muscles. Both of us going with Julian Marquez to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. A very interesting fight at the top of this card in this division. You have Jared Cannonier taking on Sean Strickland. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Couple of welterweights knock knock knocking on the division's doorstep of the rankings. We have the Celtic Kid Jake Matthews taking on Semi the Jedi Matthew Semmelsberger. Semmelsberger, the former strong safety at Marist College. I'll tell you that. John Anik will tell you that. Brendan Fitzgerald will tell you that. The guy is an athlete. And Before he came into the UFC, I thought that was all Matt Semelsberger was going to be known as. An athlete. A guy that could get taken down, could get held down, had pretty good power. I wasn't really sure of the volume. Semelsberger's wowed me, and I hope he's wowed you too in the UFC, because he looks like a much improved fighter since before he made that debut. And he took on Carlton Minus in the debut. Looked really good in that fight. Then he loses to Chaos Williams, beats Martin Sanoe, beats AJ Fletcher, and loses to Alex Morono his last time out. But for Semelsberger, what have we learned? His takedown defense has gotten better. His defensive striking is what it is. He'll kind of give one to take one on the outside. He can wrestle offensively, and you know he's got power in his fight. You saw that in the Minus fight. Martin Sanoe was in there for, what, all of 13 seconds in that one? Like, for Semelsberger, I say that, you know, he's a strong safety in college, and he weighed, you know, in and around 195 to 205 pounds. But he is a big guy for this weight class, and he really has, again, continued to improve, whether it's a crazy 88 MMA in Maryland with Coach John Delbrug, or whether it's when he trained with Tim Means over in, I wanted to say New Mexico. It is New Mexico, not Nevada.
But for NHB.
For Matt Semelsberger, again, there's a lot of glowing positives you can look at his game, and a guy at 30 years of old age that I don't really think he's peaked just yet in his game.
I don't, but I will be honest. I think this is a very difficult stylistic matchup for a guy like Matthew Semelsberger, and I think we're going to learn a lot from him in this fight, because Jake Matthews is one of those guys that right when you think he has reached his full potential, he's probably going to come up a little bit short. And I got to be honest, when you kind of write him off and you sold all your stock in him, he's going to have that Lauri Markkanen Utah Jazz season. He's really going to impress you. And I have to say, his last performance against Andre Fialho, oh my God, he impressed me in that matchup. Now, yes, and it's been a very big conversation about Andre's just career as of late. He was very active. He took a lot of damage throughout his career. So how much can you really learn? Jake Matthews faced adversity in the first round of that fight, though. He ate some big shots against a big guy in the weight division who does have really good power. And the story about Jake Matthews for the longest time was, when the going gets tough, how tough is Jake Matthews really going to get? And I know a lot of people felt like we had kind of got the answers to those questions in the Li Jingliang fight. But again, he then went on to lose. And that's always the weird thing about Matthews, too. He has been inactive. And strangely inactive through a lot of these fights. It'll be, hey, he'll have 11 months off here, he'll have 10 months off there. Not that he's taking years and years off, but if you're a guy on his way up, because he's still younger than 30 in the welterweight division, you would like to be a little bit more active, just so we would have a better idea as to how he's going to look against guys in the division. But I want to say this, because you're 100% right. Semelsberger is very big for the weight division, but just because Jake Matthews used to be a lightweight doesn't mean he's going to be at a size disadvantage in this matchup. Jake Matthews is physically really grown into the weight class. Even if you look at his last fight against Fialho, who isn't a small welterweight by any means, Jake Matthews was the bigger guy physically in that fight. And I just think that's something he's never gotten credit for. As a former lightweight who now is a welterweight, he's a big guy for the weight class.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you hate to make the connection, but I will do it. The fact that there is the Australian connection. You look at a guy like Robert Whittaker at 185 pounds. Is he a small guy? No, but he did fight at 170. Again, Rumble Johnson is the best example of that. Did he fit in at 12.5? You're gosh darn right he did. For Jake Matthews, he came in on the Ultimate Fighter Nations when he was 19 years old, Matt's favorite season, and he ended up losing to a millionaire, Olivier Aubin-Mercier. Now, that one was at 170 pounds, but Matthews went back, had a couple of fights in the regional scene, and debuted in the UFC at, well, he's still 19 years old. And since then, he's 11-5 total. He has fight of the night bonuses against Johnny Case, Li Jingliang, performance bonus last time out against Fialho. He's 7-2 in the UFC since 2017. And if you look at it, he's got a positive 0.99 strike differential, but it's 3.17 to 2.18. And the UFC average for and against is 3.4. So not a lot of offensive output from Matthews when it is on the feet, when it is at distance, which could pose a little bit of a problem against a guy like Semelsberger. You don't want to see both of those guys in a mirror. Not that I expect this to see
that. The thing is,
that
those stats go all the way back to 2014. The last version of Matthews we saw was quite aggressive, and I do feel like we have seen that progression out of his game every single time in there. That's why I feel like with Jake Matthews, he's a good example of stats are misleading, because he does take a lot of time off. Those fights are very scheduled apart. So for Matthews, the last version we saw is a dangerous fight for Semelsberger.
And for Matthews, too, the level of competition has gone up and down and up and down. Like, think about a couple of guys. I think automatically Rostam Akman and Shinjo Anzai. Are they anywhere near the level of Matt Semelsberger? Not necessarily. Then Matthews takes on Sean Brady, and those numbers take a big dip because he got ground out in that fight. So if you want another one, strength of UFC schedule. The guys that these guys have fought, all of their records combined just in the UFC. For Matthews, 56-32-1 for Semmelsberger, 13-6. So for Semmelsberger, not the same level of UFC competition. Again, he beat Martin Sanoh and he beat Jason Witt. Sanoh might still be with the UFC. I don't know. But Witt is retired. So you look at this one for a guy like Semmelsberger, a lot of straight shots, a lot of striking at distance. Size is a big thing. And we'll see if either guy decides to shoot for a takedown. I'd be eager to see that if they do get into it, if it does touch the mat.
Because I think it's interesting. I think Semmelsberger has a wrestling advantage, but I think Matthews has the grappling advantage. So we'll be interesting to see if we do get any of those exchanges on the mat. I think ever so slightly I would favor Matthews if we get a lot of grappling on the ground, just because he is an active guy from that position, and he can threaten a lot with submissions, be it offensively or defensively. He does have a good guillotine defending takedowns if Semmelsberger does find himself going for a lot. And the thing I like about Matthews is he doesn't waste a lot of energy going for submissions that he won't get. He'll use it to sweep and get into a better position. I just think for Matthews, it's always weird to have a good opinion on him, because again, like I said, former lightweight, former welterweight, he's had a lot of what-ifs, I guess, for Matthews, but I feel like the fighter that we saw, at least the last time out, if he can continue to trend in that direction, could still have a promising future, because like you said, he's been in the UFC for almost a decade now.
That's
kind of wild for a guy who's only 28 years old, so hopefully it's not one of those cases where there's not a lot of tread left on the tires. I don't think he hasn't been damaged all that much, don't get me wrong. He's been in tough fights in the past, without a doubt, but again, you don't look at a Jake Matthews and think, wow, he's like a Robbie Lawler or a Justin Gaethje or one of those fighters. So I think this will be a really entertaining fight. And the good thing for Semmelsberger is this is kind of the opponent he needed. If he wants to really get ahead in the division and jump up and prove that he can be that powerful fighter that a lot of people can believe in, Jake Matthews is the name that you want on your resume.
Semmelsberger had that shot his last time out. He got beat up in round one and round two against Alex Morono. Now, he couldn't complete the Ponce Inubio comeback in the third. He did just go out there with a blown up eye, land a jump knee, a jumping switch knee, drop Alex Morono, and then dominate large portions of that round. So for Semmelsberger, you saw that stick-to-itiveness that you love to see out of these fighters up at this top level. In terms of the odds, Matthews -220 favorite, Semmelsberger +200. We have a look at the Tapology votes. This is where I don't think they're going to be very close. No. I'm going to say over under 75% Matthews.
I think they'll be over.
I think they're going to be over. These voters, man. 603 total votes, 92% Matthews, 55% by decision, 34% by knockout. For the 8% that have Semmelsberger, 63% by knockout. I think Matthews gets the win because we said this in a few of these videos so far. Now, for Morozov, I think he can brawl well. But for Matthews, I think he's a more well-rounded fighter, and I think he can dictate where this fight takes place. And I think that's a lot different than the Chaos Williams of the world, even though that was a Semmelsberger loss, or some of the other fighters that he's faced, like Jason Witt, who could have dictated if he was able to get the wrestling going, but it was a nice straight shot out of Semmelsberger. You catch my drift. I think Matthews is a little bit more adept in terms of this matchup, and I think he's going to be able to get the win this weekend.
I think Matthews is a good enough wrestler to at least counter some of the offensive wrestling that Matt Semmelsberger brings into the cage. And the good thing about Matthews is, like you said, he's a much more dynamic striker, especially on the feet. Semmelsberger is a guy who primarily is going to throw a lot of punches. Matthews is more boxer, I would say, than kickboxer, but still, he's going to throw a hard leg kick. He's going to threaten with a lot of just different shots from different angles. Can switch stances too, and that's the thing about Matthews. Not really part of his game that we had ever seen, and then, oh my goodness, the last time out against Fialio, I was just really impressed by the fighter that we saw, at least in the second round of that matchup. And I think Matthews has reached a good stage of his career to where he can build upon a good foundational skill set. I like Jake Matthews in this matchup, and it should be a great fight.
Both of us going with Matthews out of Australia, fellow member of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth, big time fight coming up this weekend. And of course, up at the top, Jared Cannonier is taking on Sean Strickland. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say, let's get into it. 2021 saw a 2-1 ledger for buys, then Vlismas. It also saw the end of the year with a performance bonus and a fight of the night for the fighter known as the Warrior Princess. And then after December was over, things got really weird. I mean, there was a Mike Heck interview that went a little bit viral. MMA Fighting decided this was going to be the tweet. They said, Cheyenne Vlismas in hiding since UFC win, unsure when she'll fight again. And then in, brackets, it makes me want to cry. So it was a really weird...
Jan Blachowicz has never had a headline like that.
Jan Blachowicz just laughs at everything. And even when his head's murky, he's still giving wins to Magomed Ankalaev.
You want your daughter to date somebody like Jan Blachowicz? I just couldn't believe he was like, I've been in a tough fight. My body probably feels terrible. I'm at the end of my MMA career and I just lost a huge fight.
Jan Blachowicz and Kennedy and Zetchikov.
Yeah, Jan Blachowicz was like, I want you to have the belt. Not me. I've had success. Now it is your time.
It is weird, though. That's all. It was just a weird end to it. So, Liz Miss has been away for 2022. She did have a fight booked against Tabitha Ricci back in October, but she was forced to withdraw. And when you're trying to pick this fight, I got to be honest, guys. Like, I'm going to say this now instead of at the end. I have no goddamn clue who's going to win this fight. I honestly don't. Like, Cheyenne Velasquez is a great striker. We saw that in her fight, against Gloria DiPaolo. We saw that in her fight against Mallory Martin. Martin, what is she? I mean, yeah, she won that scholarship to go to Tiger Muay Thai to train. But what's Mallory Martin? A really good wrestler. And that's where her bread gets buttered. And against Velasquez, primary striking, Velasquez looked really, really good in that fight. And then you kind of parry it forward. Well, Corey McKenna, what's she good at? Well, she's great at wrestling, and I mean, we saw her struggle to get the takedown against Elise Reed. In that fight, it's a split decision loss because a judge decided I forgot how to judge in that one and gave it to McKenna, but that's okay. For McKenna, her last time out, took some time off, trained some more at Team Alpha Male, went out and fought Miranda Granger, was on, what, like a two-year layoff, and I thought Granger was going to have great success in the striking. McKenna gets her down over and over again. Second round, Von Flew choke, looks great. So McKenna parlays it forward against Blismuth. I would expect McKenna to grapple. I would expect Velasquez to try and strike from distance, and if she can't, defend takedowns. But I have no idea if that's going to happen in this fight.
I think that is a good way to break it down, too. Because, okay, let's say you would primarily have a grappler fight a striker. Normally, you favor the grappler. That's how MMA works. It favors the grappler. The weird thing is, though, these fighters are somewhat in the same tier of fighters, and they fought similar levels of competition. Like, let's say you love Cheyenne Velasquez, and you're trying to sell us the highest level package on her. You're still selling us a used Honda Civic at best. And for Corey McKenna...
No, that's too harsh.
I don't think it is, because this is the thing. For McKenna, she has obvious strengths, obvious weaknesses. And I feel like for Velasquez, she has yet to show us one area of her game that she can really go out there and just dominate higher level fighters with. Now, is she a good striker? Yes, she is. But the issue I've always had with the style of striking that Velasquez has, she throws a lot behind her shots. Like, she tries to be a power striker. And I know we talk about Jessica Andrade a lot. Like, Andrade is probably the greatest multi-weight class women's fighter of all time. I know that's a very specific category, but you understand. Yes, Andrade throws a lot of power behind her shots, but they still look like boxing combinations. It still hooks to the body, hooks to the head. For Velasquez, I always do worry that she's trying to put a little bit extra power on her shots. And I do worry about, in a fight like this, if she is really trying to load up and get McKenna out of there, could that open up a world for McKenna to then have success with her own takedowns? But the issue that I have with McKenna is, like you said, it might be a split decision to Elise Reed. Everybody who watched that fight thought Elise Reed won that fight. But it just showed you what McKenna struggles with. If she is exposed on the feet for long periods of time, if she's not able to threaten with her wrestling, she doesn't have the most complex striking. She's not someone who's going to threaten with a three-level attack. So for McKenna, until she is really able to go out there and show us another level to her game, I think this fight is difficult to predict.
I mean, to me, I just think it's harsh because McKenna, we know what her big strength is, and she's gone to a gym that accentuates that big strength. It's her takedowns, her grappling. She beat, the former champ over in LFA. She was able to get that win over Vanessa Demopoulos on Dana White's Contender Series. Looked really good there. You know, going to be one of the younger female stars in the UFC. See, fights Kay Hansen. That was a chintzy decision win. A lot of people thought Kay Hansen won that fight. Then she fights Elise Reed and loses that one. Then she beats Miranda Granger. And for Velasquez, she comes in. She takes on Montserrat Canejo. Could not figure out the upper body takedown. The old, like, big brother bully type of takedown. The head and arm throw. And then her last two times out, she has looked good. Now, again, if you do look at it for Velasquez, you go on the Instagram. She's still training at Extreme Couture. She's there with, and I'm going to mention all the names, let's go. How about Casey O'Neill? That's going to be somebody to get ready for this fight
with. Is the knee better?
Tatiana Suarez. I don't know. It's not in a brace, so it looks good
that
way.
Just with Casey O'Neill. Trust me, nobody believes in Casey O'Neill more than me, but it's just that was the longest thing. She had torn her ACL.
Casey O'Neill, Tatiana Suarez, Taylor Guardado, those fighters are going to get you ready for a fight like this. And for Corey McKenna, if you go on her Instagram, she's training in SoCal with Angela Hill and Jessica Penne. They're going to be able to give you that length look against somebody like, against Velasquez, and I know height is the same in this one. They're both listed as 5'3". You know that McKenna is going to be at a reach disadvantage against most of the people that she does fight. And if you look at her training at Team Alpha Male, she trains with Ricky Tercios. So I'm sure Ricky Tercios, if you ever train with him, he'd give you life lessons and a little bit of a striking clinic.
I just look at this fight. It's like if a shark fought a lion. Like, they would never see each other. They don't even know each other exists. But if one gets it in the water, they're going to win.
Yeah, there's parts in Africa where lions go to the ocean.
Sure, Whatever. My whole point is they would never fight. Ooh, Craig, pat yourself on the back. My whole point is if Elizabeth could keep this on the feet, she should win this fight. She's the much more damaging striker. I will be curious, though, how much Elizabeth is able to open up with her own hands, because let's say McKenna, even if she's not securing a lot of takedowns, if she's just threatening with pressure, it's going to be difficult for Elizabeth to really sit down on her own shots and land with a lot of power. Again, she's still the better striker, the more varied striker. I just worry about how much power she's really going to be able to sit down on if McKenna's the one pressuring her. I just think on the feet, McKenna is at a very obvious disadvantage, but on the mat, I do think Velismus is at a very equal type of disadvantage, because for McKenna, she does have a very high level submission game. I know she hasn't beaten the best levels of fighters in the UFC, if we're being completely honest, but at only 23 years of age, it's something that she can build upon, and that's the thing about both these fighters too. They're both still young, so I don't think we have seen a finished product out of either one of them.
In terms of the odds, Velismus open plus 125, minus 185. For McKenna, open minus 145, plus 150. We have a look at the topology votes, and apparently I have no idea where anybody's going to go with any of these. I'm going to say over under 60% Velismus.
I'll say over.
I know she's a favorite. Look at that. 580 total votes. 56% McKenna, 81% by decision for the 44% that have Velismus, 88% by decision. You said it. Grapplers usually win out in MMA if everything's considered equal. So do you think McKenna wins this fight?
If the odds were even, I would say I like Cheyenne Velismus. And I'm not one of these people who, the underdog. But I think it is an interesting matchup, because if McKenna gets this on the mat, I don't know what Velismus is going to be able to do, especially threaten off her back to either A, get up to her feet, to have her own success in the striking. And that really comes down to, okay, can Velismus hurt McKenna? She probably can, don't get me wrong, but I think she really is going to have to sit down a lot on her shots. I think this is a fight where, again, Velismus is going to have very obvious avenues of success, and the same thing has to be said for Corey McKenna, but like I kind of said in the middle of this video, if I have someone who I think is going to have a lot of success in the feet fighting someone who's going to have a lot of success in the mat, I'm ever so slightly going to pick the grappler in Corey McKenna, but I think it's a very close fight, and that's the weird thing. Like, the winner of this, are we really going to learn that much from them? Just because they're still fighting another fighter with so many question marks that it's really going to take a few more performance.
No, and I have Velismus. She hasn't won by submission since 2017 when she was an amateur, and I don't expect her to do so in this fight. But I think, again, a year away, being so young, training at Extreme Couture with some of the better women in these weight classes, working some of that takedown defense, I think that can win out for her, because I do think that she has that obvious skill advantage in her striking, conducive to getting a win in this one. So we're split on the pick. Matt going with McKenna. I'm going with the Warrior Princess Velismus. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this fight. Some big fights left on this card. I'm talking about a middleweight banger up at the top, Cannonier versus Strickland. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Fight Name Picks fans, this is a fight for you, and it's going to be a Rubik's Cube to solve the fight booking. So let me start right here. We're gonna start on the ground floor. What was originally supposed to be Bruno Silva against Albert Duraev then turned into Albert Duraev versus Michael Olaszczyk. And what was originally supposed to be Cody Brundage against one Adolfo Vieira, well, they shelved that because Vieira was out. Brundage needs a dance partner. Olaszczyk needs a dance partner. So on December the 2nd, ESPN announced Brundage is going to fight Olaszczyk, which is a really fun fight with a couple of guys that have been in camp for a very long time. You expect both guys to be fresh. You expect both guys to make the weight, which might sound halfway surprising because for Olaszczyk, longtime light heavyweight, made that middleweight debut his last time out. He's 5-3 in the UFC with a no contest. The no contest? Little bit of a USADA suspension. It was not for the sticky icky. He did beat Khalil Roundtree Jr. in his UFC debut. But for Olaszczyk, we thought the highs could be very high. And then we saw the lows could be very low. And his last fight at light heavyweight, his second to last fight, he lost to Dustin Jacoby by decision. But in that middleweight debut, he looked really good and he finished the fight very quickly. So for Olaszczyk, the power carried to 185. The size was there. The speed was there. A lot of things that he did have at light heavyweight. And for Olaszczyk, trains out of a great gym in Ancos MMA. That's a gym that you're going to see Marcin Tybura. You've seen Yaroslav Amosov train there recently. You've also seen the FEN welterweight champ. His brother, I'm going to butcher his first name, but I'm going to give it a shot. Cezary Olaszczyk, he is a champ. So for Olaszczyk, great guys to train with to get ready for a fight like this. You know how deadly that corked up left hand is. And for Brundage, a lot of people weren't sure coming into the UFC. He looked really good against William Knight until he got finished on Dana White's Contender Series. He had that fight against Nick Maximov. Some people thought he won. Some people didn't. And then he was able to go out there his last two times. He finishes Dalcho Lungiambula, where he was getting his just brains beat in until he wasn't, where he finished him by guillotine. And his last time out against Treshawn Gore, withstood the thunder. Everybody thought he was going to wrestle, and he knocked him out on the feet. Well, he dropped him, and then he finished him with ground and pound. Brundage, in his own right, has looked great his last two times out, too.
Remember when Big Pretty went from fighting Mark Hunt to Curtis Blaydes? And that was like a huge step up in competition, like an insane step up in competition. Cody Brundage going from Treshawn Gore to Michael Olishaychuk at 185, I think is a big step up in competition. And you don't need me to tell you that. Like, Cody Brundage had a lot of success against a guy who had a lot of question marks. And while, yes, Olishaychuk is a guy who still has question marks surrounding his takedown defense, potentially his gas tank as well, he is still a fairly complete product, I would say. You still know what you're going to get. I know we saw a lot more of his offensive wrestling in the Khalil Roundtree fight. A lot of people forget, like, he wrestled Khalil into oblivion in that matchup. He really did use his offensive wrestling a lot, but the thing about Olishaychuk is we've seen him struggle defensively in some of those same positions at the UFC level. And so, yes, could Cody Brundage go out there, really implement his wrestling background on a guy like Olishaychuk? I think he could, but the issue that I keep on going back to is Cody Brundage eats a lot of punches, and he has eaten quite a few shots in a lot of his matchups. Now, yes, did Nick Maximov rock him? No. But has Nick Maximov rocked anybody in the UFC? Exactly. I just worry about how Cody Brundage is going to deal with some of the power strikes of Olishaychuk, because can Brundage get a lot of control time on the mat? Can he threaten with some submissions? I think he can. I just think it's going to be really hard for Cody Brundage to have a lot of the answer for the boxing on the outside of Olishaychuk.
Yeah, and for Olishaychuk, you got to consider this. He was a minus 600 and he beat Sam Alvey his last time out. So you got to kind of consider that when you factor it in with the matchup against Brundage. And for Olishaychuk, again, the same thing could be said. He was originally due Albert Duraev, who actually fits into this category pretty well, because he has underwhelmed so far in his UFC tenure, with one win over Roman Kopylov and a couple of losses since then, and his eye always blows up. But for Olishaychuk, for all that offensive wrestling prowess, I mean, that was my big counter when he's taking on Shamil Gamzatov. What's Shamil do? Well, he's not a good striker, but he's really, really good at getting the fight down to the mat. And in that fight, Michael just pushed a pace. Shamil thought he was a power striker, and Michael was able to go out there and finish him and take that O. So in a matchup like this, you kind of touched on it. Brundage does have a wrestling background at Newberry College, and I'll throw the graphic up there now. At 197 and 287 pounds, his favorite movie in the bio is Good Will Hunting. What do you make of that movie?
Never watched it. I'm a big Ben Affleck fan, though.
You can't be if you've never watched that movie.
Yes, you can be, Craig.
And you've never seen The Big Lebowski. What movies are you watching?
I've seen The Town. I've seen Argo. I've seen a lot of Ben Affleck movies, Craig.
Have you seen Geely?
I've not seen Geely.
You're not a big Ben Affleck.
You really try to force some of these.
But if you look at it for Brundage, I mean, his favorite saying back in college was BIP. What do you think that is? Bad in person? You think it's bust in pocket?
What is it?
I don't know. It's left open to interpretation. BIP, yeah. Let us know in the comments what you make of that one. But in this matchup, Matt, Brundage obviously has a skill advantage over Olishaychuk. Olishaychuk has a skill advantage over Brundage. When we look at the odds, Olishaychuk open minus 225. He's minus 275 right now. For Brundage, open plus 190, plus 222. We have a look at the Tapology votes. I doubt they're close, but the same thing can be said in Brundage's last two fights. I'm going to say over under 75% Olishaychuk.
I think they'll be over.
My goodness, I hope I'm halfway right on this one. Okay, they're slightly over. Look at that. Okay, 490 total votes, 81% Olishaychuk, 81% by knockout. For the 19% that have Brundage, 36% by decision, 34% by submission, 23% by knockout. I don't know if those add up to 100%. They really do on Tapology. But Matt, the fans have Olishaychuk. He's a favorite in this one. You've been a big Olishaychuk supporter. Do you think he gets the win here?
I have been, and I can admit when I think a guy is probably better than they are. But with Olishaychuk, I feel like I have had a pretty realistic expectations of what his skill sets are. I've never said he's a great offensive wrestler. I've never said he really excels with the grappling. He'll threaten with defensive submissions every now and then. There you go. But again, it's not such a big part of his game that you really need to mention it. I like his offensive boxing a lot in this matchup, though. The problem with Cody Brundage is, does he have great wrestling? Yes, he does. And I think it's something he can use to his success in this matchup. But he's not a big finisher with submissions. He has good ground and pound, but I don't think it's good enough ground and pound to finish a guy like Olishaychuk. And I think if that's the case, if he gets damaged on the feet, what is he going to do to really get the judges back in his favor? And I think Olishaychuk is that kind of damaging striker. We bring it a lot up. We brought it up between Dolce's last matchup, and every time we've talked about Cody Brundage since that fight, he went through a lot to get that win, and he ate some really big power shots from a very talented striker on the outside. But the difference between Dolce and Olishaychuk is Olajay Trek's a much more, I would say, compact striker. He'll go to the body more. He's a little bit more disciplined when he goes for the finish. And I think if he gets Brundage hurt, he'll put him away and not just try to wing power shots in the outside.
Olajay Trek loves to paw that lead right hand to the body to come up with that right, or sorry, the left straight that he does have. And there's a lot of power behind it for such a straight shot. And for Brundage, I picked him in all three UFC fights, and I'm 2-1 so far, but I'm not picking him in this matchup. I'm off the train just for this one. So sorry to the Factory X fans, but for me, I'm going to go with Michael Olajczyk. I think that boxing advantage that he has, I also think he has a speed advantage in this matchup.
That's a good point.
He's great with lead foot placement, but if he leaves it out there too much, which he will do in a lot of his fights, Brundage can capitalize on that into a single leg. So a very, very interesting fight. Both of us going with Poland's Hussar, the light cavalry from way back when. Michael Olajczyk to get the win. Some big time fights on this card, including a headliner in this division between Jared Cannonier and Sean Strickland. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Bobby Green, King Bobby Green, set to come back off of a six-month USADA suspension retroactive to May, and he's going to be taking on Drew Dober out of Colorado. And I mean, he's Nebraska's own, and he's got a chin that could, I don't know, withstand a nuclear explosion if you look at it for Drew Dober. But when you look at a matchup like this, these guys have been around with Strikeforce, with the UFC for ages. And you might think, okay, like Drew Dober's put on some really exciting fights lately. And Bobby Green, about what, like a year ago, year and a half ago, he was a mover and a shaker. And then he fought Islam Makhachev in that main event. And now he's been off ever since. He's supposed to take on Jim Miller, but then there was that positive USADA suspension. But for these guys, I'm just going to go tit for tat, stat for stat. If you look at it for both of them, combined 21-5-1 with a no contest in the UFC. If you look at it for Bobby Green, I mean, my numbers didn't make any sense.
No, I was going to say Bobby Green.
I meant to say 21-15-1. Okay. Bobby Green's 10-8-1 in the UFC, and Drew Dober's 11-7 with a no contest. But Drew Dober, 2 fight of the nights, 3 performance bonuses. Bobby Green has 3 fight of the nights, 1 performance bonus, and 1 submission of the night bonus way back when at UFC 156 in 2013. These guys have been around, and I'm surprised when I did the deep dive, they were never matched up to fight each other in the past. Is that kind of surprise?
I think this fight's going to be incredible. I can't stress that enough, because neither guy has a style that's really going to surprise you. Drew Dober's going to go in there, brawl probably a little bit too much, but box for the most part, threaten with a couple takedowns, but again, for the most part, really try to set up that big left hand. He has a really good active front hand too, but he's going to eat power shots like there is no tomorrow. And it's kind of a wild part of his style. And like you said, does Drew Dober have a good chin? Yes, he does. But oh my God, it's been tested so many times now that you do wonder when it's going to run out. Now, is Bobby Green the most thunderous puncher in the world? Not at all. He's a very talented boxer, a very crisp boxer. Everybody's going to bring up the shoulder roll with Bobby Green. But he is he's much more volume than a power-oriented striker. And that's why I think this fight's going to be very interesting, because I think if it ends inside the distance, this might be wild to say, because Drew Dober, for the most part, was never a knockout artist. I know he had that little streak there where he really did seem to start sitting down a lot more on his shots. The Alexander Hernandez knockout was one that a lot of people are going to remember, because Drew Dober said, oh, you guys want to see me be more aggressive? And he did that. He went out there, charged, and just looked like the most confident version of himself in that matchup. And that's the Drew Dober that you always want to go in there and see. And that's the thing about Drew Dober. It doesn't really matter what he is like. Like, Drew Dober on short notice is the same Drew Dober that's had 2 months to prepare. You could be the 5th-ranked fighter in the world. You could be a guy coming off Contender Series. Dober's still going to offer you the kind of the same questions and the same answers to a lot of different parts of your game. And that's why it is kind of funny that you said that. Like, why have these guys never been matched up? Because this is a fight where you can match them up 10 years ago. They're around the same level in the division. 5 years ago, but at the same level in the division. These guys have always been very close to each other in the grand scheme of the lightweight division. That's why I think it's going to be such a fun fight, because I feel like people are going to look at this and say, wow, Bobby Green's the older guy. Drew Dober's the more youthful of the two, but that's not the case whatsoever. And Drew Dober has taken a lot of damage at this stage of his career, so age can be a little deceiving.
Bobby Green's fought a much higher level of competition. When you consider it for both these guys, total opponents, UFC record combined for Dober, 57-40-1. For Bobby Green, 106-57-2. Bobby Green's fought much better guys. I mean, the Poiriers, the Barbosas, when they're in their prime as well. Not to say the Poirier isn't, but Barboza, I think it's safe to say, is not. And when you consider statistically, Bobby Green is better with striking accuracy, striking defense, throws more per minute than Dober, 5.88 to 4.47. He also accepts less shots on the feet as well, 3.56 to 4.16 for Dober. So Bobby Green, in every statistical category of striking, is better than Drew Dober. But stats on a page don't take into account the level of boxing out of both these guys, because for Green, that shoulder roll works in 70% of his fights, it works really well, unless you can pressure him, wrestle him, or hit him with the power shots. For Drew Dober, he takes so many shots, but as that southpaw that can whip those strikes out there, he throws a different look. And for Bobby Green against southpaws in the UFC, he fought Islam Makhachev, and he lost. He fought Nasrat Akbras, and he won.
Okay.
He fought Alain Patrick, and he won. He fought Francisco Trinaldo, and he lost. He fought Dustin Poirier, and he lost. And he fought Jacob Volkman way back when, and he won. So at a 6 southpaws, he's 3-3, looking to kind of go over 500 or under 500 in this one.
I just think for Bobby Green, it's going to be interesting, because if Drew Dober has no respect for his punching power, I think it's going to be a tough night for Bobby Green, honestly, because he doesn't have crazy high-level power. Go back to the Nasrat Akbras fight, because it really hammers this point home. If you really respect his punching power and stay on the outside of it, it is hell to fight Bobby Green. He's going to throw a ton of strikes at you. He is elusive on the outside. If you don't respect his power, though, and get on the inside, and I know Dustin Poirier is a very high-level boxer, so it's difficult to say, hey, follow the plan that Dustin Poirier set. But again, if you don't respect his power and crowd that distance on the inside, yes, Bobby Green can shoulder roll and whatnot, but if you throw punches and combinations, he's not Muhammad Ali against the ropes. He's not going to guess right 58 times in a row. And that's why I do think Drew Dober can have success. If he can get Bobby Green's back against the cage and limit some of that good movement that he does have on the back foot, I can see a world where Drew Dober goes in there, and honestly, it's going to sound crazy, makes quick work of Bobby Green. I could see him go in there, really make it a difficult fight, go to the body, go to the head early. But that's the real question mark that you have to ask for both these guys. How much left do either guy have in the tank? Like, for Bobby Green, it always seems like after a big loss, it's, did he retire? Are we going to get Bobby Green back? That's been the case a couple of times through his career. And for Drew Dober, he's been at the top of the division. He's got knocked off. He's looking to build himself back. I just think this is a very difficult place for any fighter at this stage of their career, because a win is very important for both these guys.
And I mean, for Dober's last time out against Alves, to get that win that he had, I mean, he looked amazing, mixing it to the head, mixing it to the body.
That was a great fight.
His win over Terrence McKinney went through just, if I could say it politely, went through heck and back in that one. Got knocked down and he ended up coming back. For Bobby Green, the win that he had over Ali Aquinta before he was able to beat Nasrat Akbras retired him. And then his last time out against Makhachev, you didn't learn anything out of either guy's fight against Islam Makhachev. So the odds in this one, Dober open minus 110, both at par. He's now minus 160. Green open at a minus 110. We'll say plus 140. So relatively close between these guys. We'll have a look at the Tapology votes. I think they're going to differ a little bit. I'm going to say over, under 70% Dober.
I'll say under.
Oh, lucky duck. 640 total votes, 69% Drew Dober, 60% by decision, 32% by knockout. For the 31% that have Green, 81% by decision. I think that's fair to say. But again, for Bobby Green, every statistical striking category he beats Drew Dober in, he's a better distance striker. It just depends on if Drew Dober can close that gap or not. Dober's not the type of guy to threaten with a lot of his grappling. We don't really see that as a big part of his game. We saw Clay Guida do that in the fight against Bobby Green, and Green won that fight, rightfully so. But there's a lot of things to draw to that Guida fight that I think Dober can capitalize on, and that's why I think Dober can win this fight against Green.
I do like Dober in this matchup. I think this is going to be fight of the night, without a doubt. I think this is going to be a very high-paced fight, and a very damaging fight, too. That's the thing. Like, this is a really hard fight for both these guys to take at this stage.
I think this fight is going to be fight of the night without a doubt, and we didn't even have it in our fight of the night screen.
You're the one who set them.
Oh!
I think Drew Dober is going to win this fight, though. Again, this seems to me like Bobby Green's fighting a younger version of himself. And not that Drew Dober does everything the same, but I do think Dober has a little bit more left on the tires. And the thing about Bobby Green is, he doesn't sit down on his shots like some of the guys who have been able to hurt Drew Dober in the past. I know Terrence McKinney, he might be kind of an up-and-down fighter. When he sits down on punches, though, he really does hurt guys. But think about the Brad Riddell fight even with Drew Dober. Dober hurt Riddell more than Riddell hurt him on the feet. So I think for Drew Dober, you're right. Do the stats slightly point towards Green? Yes, they do. But I think Green's going to face a lot of pressure in this matchup, and I think that's going to open up Drew Dober's striking.
Both of us going with Drew Dober to get the win in the matchup. Let us know down below who you have in a battle between longtime lightweights in this UFC's division. And if you look at the upper echelon of this card, there's also another great fight in the co-main event in this division between Armin Tsarukyan and Demir Ismagulov. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Guys, I'm going to do my best Mike Goldberg. Coming up next, we have a guy that's proof that third time's the charm is a real saying. Oh, yeah. Juicy J Giuliana-Rosa in his third stint with the UFC is 5-1, and he's been an underdog in 5 of those 6 fights. He continues to prove the doubters wrong, and he is knocking on the door of the rankings, taking on Alex Caceres, a guy who has been around with the UFC since 2011. And if you look at it for Caceres, for Bruce Leroy, owns his own gym now, trains out of Florida. He's 14-11 with a no contest since debuting against Mackin Smerzier, WEC legend, back in 2011. And for Caceres, his first 2 fights in the UFC, lost them by submission. That just goes to show you the stick-to-itiveness of not just Arosa, but of both of these guys. And they faced a very high-level competition. For Arosa, he lost on The Ultimate Fighter by knockout, season 22. To the GOAT, Artem Lobov. He also lost to Paddy Pimblett in 2016 with Cage Warriors. Very chintzy and controversial loss there. But if you look at it for Giuliana-Rosa, since he's just added tools to his tool belt, since he's gone from the Pacific Northwest to Extreme Couture, he's just gotten even better. And I know he spends time at 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu with Casey Halstead, one of the underrated coaches that you don't hear enough about out of Vegas. For Rosa, though, we've seen him in these performances kind of let down that shell. Somehow he's toughened up his jaw. I don't know if he's been using those, like, ball, like that.
Would you agree with me, though? I think Giuliana-Rosa is one of those, you catch him early, you might be able to knock him out. But if he is able to ease himself into the fight, he's a very difficult guy to finish.
Like, we talk about the storm that doesn't go away. Giuliana-Rosa is that guy. And it's got to be scary when you're in the third round and this guy hasn't gone away. Like the fight against Hakeem Dawodu that we saw his last time out. Rosa just continues to show up in waves. It's like a Call of Duty map when you're playing single player at your house when you're not attached to the internet. Giuliana-Rosa is that guy. He is 2012. But for Arosa, again, 5-1 in this recent run. Some of the level of competition hasn't been the best, but some of it has. The win against Sean Woodson, where he goes through adversity, beating Charles Jourdain as a big underdog, beating another Canadian, Hakeem Dawodu. For Caceres, the same thing can be said. I mean, in the win streak that he had before he lost last time out against Sadiq Youssef, which was a closer fight than it might just, you know, suggest numbers on a page, but beating Chase Hooper, beating Austin Springer, beating Kevin Kroom, beating Sungwoo Choi, those guys are either not with the company or they've had a rough run of late. But for Caceres, he did look good in a lot of those fights. Even in the Choi fight, he gets dropped, he gets back up, he gets the back, and he looks really good. So for both of these guys, they're kind of cut from that same cloth where they're going to go, like, Chris Tyone should be the referee in this fight.
But that's why it's really difficult to rank them kind of in the overall ecosystem, if you will, of the division. Because Giuliana-Rosa is going to be a difficult fight for the number one contender. But a guy out contender series is also probably going to offer him a very difficult fight because he is hittable. And that's the thing about Giuliana-Rosa. Yes, he has been able to get over some of the earlier finishes that he had earlier on in his career. But you don't look at Giuliana-Rosa and think, wow, his striking defense, boy, did it look great tonight. Now, is Alex Caceres as heavy-handed of a striker that's really going to take advantage of that? Not necessarily, but Caceres is a very technical striker, and I know he has added a lot more to his grappling in this stage of his career because, for the most part, it was, hey, Alex Caceres, if you squint from a long distance, he's kind of like Gary Rodriguez. They had a main event against each other. People don't believe me when I tell them that, too, because, like, the UFC has scrubbed the history of that from their whole history because it was a close fight, went to a split decision. Wild. Yeah, here I did think one by the end of it, but still, that just tells you where Alex Caceres was at one point in the organization. And like you said, the fact that he's been around for so long and he still has been able to maintain relevance is just said, like, hey, Alex Caceres is a really talented striker. The one, I guess, concern that I do have for both these guys in this matchup is, what's Giuliana-Rosa going to do if Alex Caceres just has really good footwork? Because for Rosa, he does have a bit of a zombie style and he will follow his opponent. And if a guy like Caceres is doing a good job sticking and moving, I think Rosa might have a really hard time finding him in the cage.
Like, Caceres will stick and move laterally very, very well. For a guy that's this advanced in his career, to have the record that he has, to be the age that he is, he's ranked 15th in this division for a reason. And if you look at it and you compare their styles, Giuliana-Rosa has really good footwork and he's really wonky kind of on his entries and he holds his hands really low for a guy who has primarily been knocked out in all of his losses except for what, one? I think the Paddy Pimblett loss is the only decision one that's on there. But if you look at it for Arosa, he has definitely added tools to his tool belt. But my comp in this one is, and everybody loves the record, so we'll go with one to end the season. I got such a long way to go to make it to the border of Mexico, so I ride like the wind. You face both of these guys, it's kind of the same thing. For Rosa, it comes in waves. For Caceres, you have to really try and figure him out. And even when you think you have him out of there, like Sungwoo Choi did, Caceres just kind of gets back into it, gets the finish in his own right. So you look at this matchup, Arosa is actually a favorite in this one. So again, out of the six fights back in the UFC, the only time Arosa was favored to win was when he took on Steven Peterson. That was a wild fight of the night. And Caceres coming in as the underdog. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Arosa in those last two big wins, like that I look at, the one against Daoudou, the one against Jourdain. Against Jourdain, 18% of the Tapology voters had Arosa to win. And his last time out, 19% had him to beat Hakeem Daoudou. I'm going to say in this one, now all of a sudden it's going to be a flip of the script. And it might even be a little bit of an overcorrection. I'm going to say over under 62.5% Arosa.
Under.
Under. And it's over. 662 total votes, 72% Arosa, 77% by decision. For the 22% that have Caceres, 69% by decision. I have no idea what these Tapology voters are doing this week. They're all over the place. So what's your pick on this fight?
I have no idea who's going to win this fight. This is a really difficult fight to predict because Julian Arosa is very volatile. Like, insanely so. He could get knocked out in the first round. He could win by knockout in the third round. He's tougher than a $2 stake, but also he's been finished a lot of times in the past. It's really hard to get a solid read on Julian Arosa and what version of Arosa you're going to get on any given evening. The steadiness of Alex Caceres is something I do like in this matchup, but with that being said, I do have Julian Arosa. I do think his forward pressure is going to offer a lot of difficulties for Alex Caceres, because if Caceres isn't able to get his own takedown, he's not the most heavy-handed of strikers. Yes, he's a flashy striker, but if Arosa doesn't respect the power coming back his way, I don't see a world where Julian Arosa isn't comfortable just walking forward, throwing with his own combinations. Caceres has gotten better at this stage of his career, but the one thing that has always troubled Julian Arosa is guys with immense physical strength. If you're a really strong guy, you can out-wrestle Julian Arosa. You can kind of bully him in the clinch. Is Caceres that guy? Not really. They're both cut from that same cloth, and that's why I do like Julian Arosa in this matchup, but it should be a great fight.
Alex, like, should they have the entry question on the interview? Alex, you're a really strong guy. And he goes, even if he just questions it for a second,
like, eh,
you're out. I like Alex Caceres in the matchup, and I'll tell you why. For Julian Arosa, I love the wins. I picked him against Daoudou early in the week. That was a nice underdog. However, Daoudou weighed 149.5, and that definitely affected him. The fight against Charles Jourdain is my example why I think Caceres can win. Jourdain looked good early until he didn't in the third round, and then it was Julian Arosa starting to take over, caught him, submitted him, got the win. For Alex Caceres, I don't think he's going to leave himself out there. I think his footwork in round one and round three are still going to be there, and I think Caceres can cause those problems on the outside that some of these other guys haven't. Sean Woodson was able to do it. Until, again, he wasn't at the end. And I think Caceres is one of those guys who's been around long enough that he's not going to blow his load in the first round. He'll still have things to offer in the second and the third in the matchup. So that's why I have him in this one.
You're not going to convince me. I think Arosa's
going
to win.
Not going with Arosa. I'm going with Caceres. Let us know down below in the comments section. The pendulum swung, and everybody's in on Arosa right now. Are you as well, or do you have Bruce Leroy? A lot of great fights left on this card, but only a few of them. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Out of the matchup is Alex Perez. Out of the matchup is Brandon Royval. And in on short notice, we have No-No, Alessandro Costa, somebody that UFC fans might know, they might recognize, might be one of my favorite fighters from Dana White's Contender Series. Not to say that his performance was all that great, but for Alessandro Costa, he did fight on Contender Series this past summer. Week one, four fights, beat Joe Pyfer. So everybody forgets about all the other fighters that were on that episode. Now, Anton Turcali got a win there, ended up in the UFC after the fact. You also had Dennis Bazookia, who continues to campaign for a shot over on Twitter. He's not there yet, but for Costa, he fought with Lux. He was a champ over there. He wins that fight by split decision. And then he has to get another win over with Lux and end up in the UFC. But we talked extensively about Costa on our Dana White's Contender Series preview show. And I would be remiss if we missed that preview. So we're going to throw it on back to that. Update you with Costa's last performance. And then talk about Amir Albar. The last fight that's on this card, which is actually the first fight that's on this card. Alessandro Costa, the Lux flyweight champion, is going to be taking on a man who's undefeated. And I've talked about him and his brother before. You have Adrian Luna Martinetti. You also have Andreas, who's fighting this weekend. And when I look at that fight, that's kind of my marquee, like, can't-miss matchup. It's at flyweight. There was a lot of chatter whether or not this fight would be at bantamweight. Because if you look at it, for Luna, He's got experience in both divisions. He's also 5'7". He's bigger than most guys at bantamweight and at flyweight. Made weight successfully coming in this week, which you obviously love to see. And if I can give you the particulars there, Martinetti in at 126. You have Costa in at 126 as well. Costa's 5'3". He's like a John Lineker, John Dodson type in this division. And I look at these two guys when they fight, and I don't know how much tape study he did, kind of getting ready for just that fight. That's where my pick's going to come in. But I think this fight's going to be a lot of fun, and I think the winner's probably going to end up with a contract.
I would agree with that, but here's the thing. Based off last season, every winner's probably going to get a contract on this show.
My overall breakdown of Martinetti, of Luna, goes out there, strikes very long, keeps his hands low, which can help him with the threat of the takedown. He does have wonky striking. He does take long periods of inactivity when he does strike, but his kicks are a major force in his game because he doesn't tend to box a lot from range. It's a lot of kicks. It's a lot of front kicks. It's a lot of things you have to look out for. And then when I compare him to a guy like Costa, Costa's actually been taking on a decent level of competition. He's a Brazilian training out of Mexico from that camp of Diego Lopez, who a lot of people were excited about
they
on Contender
were.
Series as well, UFC adjacent, so on and so forth. But again, Lux is one of those promotions, like, I look at it, who was it? Genaro Valdez that fought Matt Frivola was a Lux guy. He's kind of fire with fire. But when I watch Costa, this guy, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, great takedowns, very small for the division, very compact, keeps his hands really high, ducks and moves with the punches. Sometimes when he brings his hands down, he forgets that he can move, and he leaves himself.
Is he the spiritual successor to your boy Douglas De Silva, Douglas Silva de Andrade?
He kind of is, and that's what I like out of him. I know he's got, again, Kike Gonzalez that he took on his last time out. He wobbled him with a lot of shots. He was able to take him down. He was able to threaten with his grappling, with his submission ability. Jorge Calvo Martin, whose name was spelled a couple of different ways in some of the fights, that was another good one. I go all the way down through it again. 2018, he's losing in combate to Ivan Hernandez Flores that was 9-2-1, which was a decent level of competition. So again, for me, when it comes down to it, making a pick this week, I know size is in the court of Andreas Luna Martinetti. I know so on and so forth, but I do like Costa in that fight. All right, so for Costa in that episode, when he's taking on Luna Martinetti, he ends up getting the split decision win in the second round. He throws a short right hand, drops his opponent, and that's kind of the calling card for Costa in all of these fights. But if you go watch his fight that he had not that long ago, back in October, against Carlos Gomez, I mean, the former 2015 Gold Glove winner, you know, Go-Go. Didn't you like him? He was flashy.
He was pretty good, actually.
He had a lot of fun, Carlos Gomez. But if you look at the fight against the Costa had over there with Lux, it's 12 seconds. He throws a right hand. And like Carlos Gomez would throw for the bleachers or swing for the bleachers, that was kind of his thing. Costa lands that right hand, and his opponent does like almost like a 360 and lands on his face. And Costa looks so scared that he knocked him out that bad.
He did. What a gentleman. Gotta be honest, though. Fighting Amir Albazi in your debut was a tough ass.
So Costa's good with jiu-jitsu, and we know the gym that he trains out of by now. For Albazi, trains out of Extreme Couture with the Basharat brothers. You know that he was a, what, six-time Swedish Brazilian jiu-jitsu champion. For Albazi, he is that grappler in this division. And again, he was matched up with Alex Perez and Brandon Royval. The only way I see Costa winning this fight is catching Albazi with a hand. And Amir Albazi strains very straight up with his hands quite low, and he is susceptible to getting hit.
And I don't think saying that is disrespecting Costa's chances in this fight. I think Amir Albazi would offer a tough fight to Mateusz Nicolau, honestly. Like, not saying he'd win, I'm just saying, like, going into that fight, I don't know what the odds would be. I don't know what the Tapology predictions would be. Like, you get the idea. That would be a very competitive matchup, and I think very highly of Mateusz Nicolau. So for Costa, could he have one of those stock-raising losses? That could be on the table, but there's some times that the UFC sets people up in one of these no-win situations, and you hate to say this, and I really wish I could break this down more in depth, but like, Amir Albazi, like you said, is one of those grapplers who, if you're a guy in the top 5, top 10, you need to game plan strictly for this guy for 2 months, and you are still going to have a really hard time.
Yeah, the only thing that scares me a little bit in it, you talk about the Basharat brothers, how good they are with their hands, but they're very well-rounded on the mat, and they continue to show that in their fights, and for Albazi, it's almost like the opposite. He's so good on the ground that he started to show a little bit more on the feet. And I think if he tries to expand upon that, I'm going to sound like Joe Rogan when Habib fought Ally Quinta. Don't do it. This isn't the fight to do it. I don't want to see it. And we did see it a little bit against Francisco Figueiredo. So for Albazi in the UFC, beats Malcolm Gordon by triangle, beats Jaga Shumagula, beats Francisco Figueiredo, favored to win all three of those fights and heavily in some of them. But again, it does scare me a little bit where he will kind of leave those hands at about chest height, walk around, throw a little bit of boxing. He's a little stiff, a little straight up. And against a guy like Costa, it's a little scary. And for Costa, I mean, the picture, now I took that off his Instagram and he's yoked up in most of it anyway, but he was listed in some of his fights before he came into the UFC at 5'3", so he's at a disadvantage height-wise, but he has really good takedowns. He has really good jiu-jitsu. He has really good boxing. In this fight, I don't know if he'll be able to accentuate those, but I think Costa's going to be one of those guys. He's going to be around for a really long time in this division. He's not going to flare out, even if he loses, wins or loses to Albazi. You're going to see Costa for a really long time. Seems like a bit of a disservice, but also, finally, you're in the UFC, and I thought he should have been in the UFC anyway off the Contender Series win.
That's great and all, but, like, his first fight in the organization is really difficult. Again, I don't know why the UFC does this. Like, they know how to promote some prospects, and I understand they're going to heavily promote some people more than others. But if they think of Paddy Pimblett, a guy who's been in the headlines a lot, he got a pretty slow burn his first few fights, right? They didn't give him, like, Demir Ismagulov right out the way. Like, they started giving him guys who are slowly better fight after fight after fight. For Costa, you would expect a similar kind of build-up. Not, hey, you want to fight Amir Albazi on a week's notice?
And if you go back to the Shorty Torres fight that Albazi had over with Brave, like, yeah, Shorty Torres can have experience there, but Shorty Torres would most likely be a top 15 UFC fighter if they decided not to get rid of him. Costa wants to take it to the ground. That's like wearing a wetsuit against a shark. Like, that's just a dumb idea. You're going to be a seal. It's going to be game over. So we look at the odds in this one. Albazi open minus 400, minus 450. Costa open plus 250, plus 340. High on Costa. I wouldn't anchor anything to this one. We have a look at the topology votes. Matt, surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 90% Albazi.
I'll say over.
Man, they are just wild this week. 586 total votes, 94% Albazi, 67% by submission for the 6% that have Costa, 35% by decision, 35% by knockout. I think Albazi wins the fight. It might not have been the most fun fight, but hey, you got a pretty good look at Alessandro Costa and why I like him.
Hopefully it shows us something good, but the only issue is, like, if you play basketball against someone way better than you, like an NBA-level player, you don't really learn anything because they're that much better than you. And I don't think Albazi is worlds away from Costa. But at a certain point, you have to match up people who are in their skill pool, at least. And I really do think with Albazi, they're doing Costa a huge disservice. I like Amir Albazi quite a bit in the matchup. But again, it's a weird fight having a guy who is one of the top-ranked fighters in his weight class fighting someone making their debut.
We'll see if No-No can throw like he had Hernandez do against Dariush. But both of us in the matchup going with the Prince, Amir Albazi, to get the win, bringing it back to Extreme Couture. Coach Eric Nixick has another pupil in the main event, Sean Strickland, who's taking on Jared Cannonier. Not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time lightweight co-main event coming up this weekend. It's better than the lightweight feature that was the co-main event and the pay-per-view last weekend. We have Armin Tsarukyan taking on Demir Ismagulov with big-time implications in terms of this division's ranking system. And if you look at it for Ismagulov, you look at it Armin Tsarukyan, their last times out, their opponents, the fans, Montreal Screwjobs. If you do look at it for Tsarukyan, most thought that he was able to get the win over Mateusz Gamrot his last time. And for Ismagulov, most thought that Guram Khatatzeladze was able to get the win against Ismagulov. How it shakes out in this one, and by most, we'll go to the numbers in that one. If you look at it on MMA decisions, it was the majority, though, that did have it. But if you do consider it, Matt, when you do look at both these guys, for Armin Tsarukyan, he's been able to do what Demir Ismagulov couldn't do in the time that they've been in the UFC. Tsarukyan's continued to move and shake, and for Ismagulov, came in 2018, beats Alex Georges, and then takes a lot of time off between a lot of these fights to find himself into the rankings, beating Khatatzeladze his last time out. And now finally at 31, we're hoping, you know, wheels are in motion. We'll get to see him a little bit more often.
I just think for Tsarukyan, he has had the better opportunities in the UFC. Like, you have to remember, this guy made his debut against the current champion of the weight class. So for Tsarukyan, he really did hit the ground running once he did come to the organization. And that's the thing. Like, some fighters get very difficult matchups. We just got done talking about Costa and Amir Albazi. Like, that's a really hard debut. Tsarukyan found himself in one of those kind of no-win fights, and although he didn't win the fight, he gained a lot of stock in the matchup, and that's the weird thing about Tsarukyan. he's looked his best in his two losses in the UFC, and that is weird to say. You're thinking, hey, he was on the wrong end of the result, but still, the way that he was able to compete with Gamrot and with Islam Makhachev, and just knowing how skilled they are, still gives you a lot of promise with Sarukian moving forward. And the thing that I liked out of Armin on his way up to that last fight against Gamrot was we had really seen an uptick in his ground and pound aggression. It wasn't just the wrestling. It was, hey, he's going to get you to the ground and really make you pay for all those moments on the mat too. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see how he judges the distance against a guy like Demir Ismagulov, because for Ismagulov, he does have really good range setting. I know it's weird, you think about him as kind of that well-rounded fighter, and yes, he is very well-rounded, but he has a phenomenal jab, and that's the great thing about Ismagulov. If he wants you to be far away from him, he's going to fight in a way that's going to keep you far away from him. If he doesn't want you far away from him, though, he does have the grappling in his back pocket, and that's why I think this fight's so fun. If they wrestle for 15 minutes, I genuinely don't know who's going to end out on top. Is Sarukian the better wrestler just for wrestling's sake? Yes. But has Ismagulov showed anything in his UFC tenure to think he's going to get held down for 15 minutes by a guy like Sarukian? Not at all. But the flip side is, I think Demir's at least a steadier fighter on the feet. But I'm not going to I'm not going to sit here and tell you, oh, he's going to win every moment on the feet. And that's why this is such a great
one. And Ismagulov, go back to his M1 time when he was the champ over there. It really was that ground game, the ground and pound. He could really throw his opponents for a loop, and he's going for his 20th straight win if he gets this one against Armin Tsarukyan. For Demir, like, again, last fight, split decision against Guram. If you look at it, MMA decisions, 11-4 for Khatatladze. Judge Jason Stafen scored at 30-27 Ismagulov. That was his first decision with a major promotion since 2018.
You're saying when it was a robbery. It was a close fight.
When he judged a Sage Northcutt fight. Before that, for Ismagulov, took on Rafael Alves. In that one, he got dropped by the first flurry that Alves threw. He ended up winning that round, and then in the third round, he kind of did tucker out a little bit. And for Ismagulov, same thing as Dricus du Plessis. What does du Plessis do in every fight? He heaves and hoes, and he sucks a lot of wind. For Ismagulov, he blinks a lot with his right eye. So if he starts to do that in the fight, don't get thrown off. It's something that he does very, very often. For Sarukyan in his fight against Gamrot, 15-7 scored it for him over Gamrot. But out of all of these things, the most interesting part of this fight, Matt, Demir Ismagulov's fought out of a few different gyms, but for a lot of his career, he's fought out of Tiger Muay Thai. Good friends with Piotr Jan. He's training at American Top Team for this fight. Armin Tsarukyan's training at a Tiger Muay Thai with Piotr Jan for this fight. That's a huge advantage for Tsarukyan getting ready for Ismagulov to be able to have that wherewithal, the coach's knowledge to get ready for this one, just like Edmund Shahbazyan had last week getting ready for Dalcha Linjambula.
I think Edmund was going to win that fight probably no matter what. This is a unique fight, though, because, again, the winner has so much to gain, and the loser has a lot to risk, too, because think about how long it took these guys to reach just this point, just to co-main event a fight night. And yes, Armin has had a main event in the past, but still.
His last fight, yeah.
It has taken a lot for these guys to just reach this level in the MMA world. There's fighters who are nowhere near as skilled as they are, who they're in co-main events all the time. Carlos Felipe fought in like 10 straight co-main events, and I wouldn't say he is the level of fighter either one of these guys are. The weird thing is, though, it's going to be really interesting to see how Ismagulov's able to scramble with a guy like Sarukyan, because up until this point, Ismagulov has been taken down, but then he'll be able to work on top, threaten with submissions. You get the idea. He's not a guy who stays stationary off his back. And for Sarukyan, we saw him maybe struggles a little bit too far, but have a lot of those 50-50 exchanges with a guy like Gamrot in that matchup. So I'll be interested in two very distinct things in this fight. How long can Ismagulov keep this at long range? Because I think at long range, he has a distinct advantage. I do like his jab. I like his straight shots a lot, too, because that's the thing about Sarukyan. He's improved a lot on his striking in the UFC, but he's still a little wild with it. And yes, the wildness can be effective, but against a guy like Ismagulov, who stands on the outside so far away, I think he's going to be able to see a lot of those attacks coming, and I think he'll be able to counter from the outside. But if Sarukyan can get on top and stay on top, it'll be a great position. Remember the Joel Alvarez fight? He got on top of him and beat him into the ground.
That boy brutalized that other fella.
Alvarez has really good defensive jiu-jitsu, too. Like, probably the best part of his game is his jiu-jitsu off his back. Armin Tsarukyan made him look like he was just another guy.
But both of these guys excel where the other one struggles. For Demir, straight shot, Tsarukyan trying to get in through that distance, cut through it, he can get tagged up. For Demir, what does he struggle against? Oddly enough, the wildness, and for Tsarukyan in the fourth round of his fight against Gamrot, spinning backfist dropped him, and that really is the advantage that Tsarukyan has. It's a lot of odd angle shots. He will come at you from different levels as well, because he's going to threaten in that takedown, whereas for Ismagulov, the fight against Georges is kind of the hallmark. He just ground that guy out. Yeah. Georges, we haven't seen him in the UFC since. So when you do look at this matchup, the odds, Ismagulov open +190, +147, Tsarukyan open -225, -177. We have a look at the total votes on Tapology, and I have no gosh darn idea where any of these things have been today. I'm going to say over under, fans like Tsarukyan, I'm going to say over under 67.5% Tsarukyan.
I think they'll be over.
I think they're going to be over. Slightly over. 712 total votes. You feel good when they're that close. 69% Tsarukyan, 83% by decision for the 31% that have Ismagulov, 89% by decision. So the fans thinking this three-round fight, going to go to a decision. Zarukian's first five-round fight of his, 21-fight pro career? That was his first five-round fight, his last time out. But Ismagulov had all kinds of five-round experience when he was with M1.
The thing with Tsarukyan was, though, looked great in a five-round atmosphere. Yep. His pace did not fall off really whatsoever throughout that fight. That was a grueling fight between those two guys. Like, that was fought at a very high pace. I think Ismagulov is going to offer Tsarukyan a lot of trouble on the outside. Again, I really do think Armin, with his looping style of striking, is going to leave Ismagulov a lot of windows open to counter. But again, I kind of played my trap card there. Joel Alvarez is amazing at jiu-jitsu. Like, very, very, very high level at it. Can submit other high-level jiu-jitsu artists. He had nothing, and I mean nothing, in terms of grappling as an answer to what Armin Tsarukyan was able to do on the ground. Now, yes, was Ismagulov, or does Ismagulov, have very good scrambles and very good counters to the wrestling? He does. But I don't think Ismagulov can get on top of Tsarukyan at all. Islam Makhachev wasn't able to do that, so I doubt Demir's going to be able to. So that's why I do like Armin in this fight. I think it's going to be fought at a very high pace, though. So I'll be interested to see if either guy does tire due to the pace, because I feel like the automatic answer would say, hey, watch out for Ismagulov late, but I could see a world where Tsarukyan is spending a lot of energy early, going for a lot of those takedowns. Ismagulov's doing a good job, kind of flowing with them, not really using a lot of his energy to defend. And maybe Tsarukyan is a little bit more tuckered out by the end of this matchup, but it's a very high level
fight.
Well,
for Tsarukyan, I don't know if it was just because it was the first five round fight. You want to conserve his gas tank a little bit, but round one, round two, or Gamrot for sure. Round three, maybe it was Gamrot, maybe it was Tsarukyan. Round four, round five, exactly. Then Tsarukyan. So I did like that uptick as the fight went on. For Ismagulov, we saw him slow against Alves in that third round of his fight. We saw him dropped in the first round, but it was one of those ones like Jonathan Martinez, Alejandro Perez. You get dropped. And it was the biggest shot of the fight, or of that round, but Ismagulov won all of that round other than that drop. So it will be interesting to see who can get out to an early lead and who has to play catch-up, if they do at all. If we're right in a mirror going tit-for-tat, that's what makes it great, too. I like Tsarukyan with the fact that I think he can dictate a lot more of the pace of this fight. But again, like you said, from distance, and I harped all over distance strikers and how good that could play into their game plans last week at the pay-per-view, and that turned out pretty well for both of us. Ismagulov's one of those guys at distance that can really dictate where the fight takes place. So both of us going with Armin Tsarukyan. It's a really, really hard fight if you're trying to offer up a prediction, but a really fun one if you're trying to do a preview. I think that also, again, Master of Sport and Army hand-to-hand combat for Ismagulov, and that, again, trap card of I'm training at your gym now from Tsarukyan, trying to lay out those different tips and tricks. I think that could play out well for Tsarukyan too.
I just hope that this fight gets the respect it deserves, because we talk about a lot of divisions right now that are kind of going through this weird, hey, the prospects are killing off a lot of the more prominent names of the division. I thought Ismagulov and Tsarukyan wouldn't fight each other. They'd be matched up with more of the more some of the more prominent ranked fighters in this division. It's too bad that we are getting this fight where there are kind of 15 and 16 ranked, but this is as high level of a lightweight fight as you can possibly get. I agree with you. I also have Tsarukyan in the matchup, but if this was fight of the night, I wouldn't be surprised at all. If we had a great scramble fest where it's a back and forth fight on the feet, I think it would make for a great viewing. And again, hopefully both guys get the respect they deserve, because they are high level contenders.
9 against 13 is Ismagulov training with Gamrot over at ATT. Uh-oh, both of us going with Tsarukyan in the matchup. Let us know again down below who you have in this one. Cannoneer versus Strickland up at the top. Can't wait for it. Keep locked in with Fight Name Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time main event. Coming up this weekend, we have Killer Gorilla Jared Cannoneer coming off an unsuccessful title bid, UFC 276 not that long ago, taking on Sean Strickland coming off of a very disappointing loss TKO in the first round to your now champ, Alex Pereira. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen on the respective socials, at Matt Allen FNP. And I know we're really amped up for this fight because for both of these guys, main event experience in the past. For Cannoneer, again, his last fight against Adesanya, but he is 2-1 in those main events that he's had. He got a big time win when he took on, oh my, Jack Hermanson over Hermanson, hometown guy, big fight there. He beat Calvin Gastelum in a main event as well. For Strickland, he beat Hermanson in a main event. He also beat Uriah Hall, who's now a training partner of Sean Strickland over there at Extreme Couture. So for both of these guys, looking to make moves, start grooves, you know, we're talking up in the top 10 upper echelon of this middleweight division. And for Cannoneer, obviously at 38, you know, that title window is starting to close, even though he's proven he's definitely an elite middleweight in this division. The lone losses, one to Robert Whittaker, breaks his arm off the kick of Whittaker. And then if you look at it, the last time out against Adesanya. And for Sean Strickland, he's just kind of been a hot knife through butter against a lot of these middleweights up until he fought that somewhat inexperienced Alex Pereira and did not game plan well for that fight. So it seemed.
Hot knife through butter is an exaggeration for what Sean Strickland has done.
You like that? I didn't say hot butter through knife through hot butter. See, I messed it up in the past. I got it this time.
The thing for Strickland is, though, he didn't look that impressive even in his main event wins. And the thing with Strickland is, he might not have the most eye-catching talent, but he is a very well-rounded fighter. He's someone who can excel with his volume boxing. He does have probably surprising power that a lot of guys don't expect because he is a former welterweight now fighting at 185 pounds. And I feel like that is so far removed that a lot of people have forgot that he was a welterweight because he is a big guy for the weight division. Like, you see him scale or size up against Alex Pereira. He's not bigger than Pereira, because Alex is about as big as a middleweight can be. But again, you're kind of surprised to think, wow, Sean Strickland used to fight at 170 pounds. And even when you go back and watch his fights at 170, he is noticeably way bigger than everybody he fights down there. So I feel like with Strickland, it's not a case of, wow, he's a way different fighter at 185 than he was at 170. He's a much more comfortable fighter at 185, though, than 170. And every fighter has this story. Rumble Johnson's always the one I think of, though. It was, hey, when he fought at 170, the whole camp was just spent cutting weight and not working on his skill set. And then when he fought at 185, 205, he was able to focus a lot more on his skill set and a lot less on just the weight cut. And I think for Strickland, he's probably cut from a similar cloth because is what he's doing now all that different than what he did at 170? Not really. He just has more pop on his shots. I think he has more confidence in his gas tank too. And that's the thing that I do like about Sean Strickland. He's not going to maybe wow you with his volume, but he is a steady fighter. And we did see that a lot in that Uriah Hall matchup. But I just don't really know where Sean Strickland goes after the last fight that he had. Like, that was a weird fight for Strickland. He was fighting a guy who is one of the great kickboxers of all time. Strickland himself is a primary striker. I know he does have a bit of grappling in his back pocket, but for the most part, if Sean Strickland's going to win an MMA fight, he's going to go out there and try to strike with you. I just don't know if it's too soon. And Sean Strickland didn't get completely flatlined or anything, but we brought this up a lot. We talked about Tai Tuivasa fighting Sergey Pavlovich a couple weeks ago. It was, hey, Tai Tuivasa was in a really difficult fight. And yes, it wasn't only a month ago. It wasn't 2 months ago. But it would still be nice if we had a few more time or a few more months, a few more weeks to have to really get ready for that fight. With Strickland, I wonder if he has given himself enough time to face a guy like Jared Cannonier, who although isn't the tactician or the technician, a guy like Pereira is, he can bang when he hits you, especially if you're moving forward like Sean Strickland tends to do.
Yeah, to go back and reel it in a little bit, if you weren't impressed by his main event against Uriah Hall, I don't know what gets you up in the morning. I don't know what
Uriah Hall wasn't in his prime, though.
Uriah Hall was on a run up until that point.
But again, Uriah Hall wasn't in his prime at that stage.
Anderson Silva. He was on a really run.
Anderson Silva, the guy Jake Paul just beat?
We're talking different
sports. No, but my point is, Anderson Silva was 45 when he fought Uriah Hall. Beating Anderson Silva doesn't mean, wow, you're a world beater. I don't think Uriah Hall was in his prime when Sean Strickland beat him. I don't think that's a controversial
thing. If you were not impressed by Strickland beating Hall, you let us know down below in the comments. But when it comes to this matchup, Matt, these guys are definitely strikers. Who's going to be more apt to take the fight down to the ground might actually surprise you. I know Sean Strickland throughout his UFC career, probably he does have a better stat line. Maybe Jared Cannonier wants to try and mess around on the mat. I doubt it. But again, if we're trying to play devil's advocate for the ground games in this one, that's the way it is. But if you do look at this, you break it down from the eye test, but numerically, Sean Strickland's the much better distance striker. 1.54 distance strikes per minute on his line to a negative 0.38 for Cannonier on that same clip. And go back and break down some of the fights. Look at Jared Cannonier versus Derek Brunson. When does he win that fight? When he crashes that distance and he's able to land in tight. Couple of really nice shots. His elbows are great. His uppercuts are great when he gets in close. Clinch game for both of these guys. Cannonier's probably got the advantage in that over a guy like Sean Strickland. And for Strickland, yeah, you might look at just highlights and say, okay, you just said Sean Strickland's good at distance, but I watched him fight Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos at 170 and get spinning wheel kicked. Yes, you did. But apart from that, and especially on the run that he's had at middleweight, distance has been a friend of Sean Strickland.
Jocko fight 6 years ago.
The fight that he was able to have against Jack Marshman, the former paratrooper. The Uriah Hall fight, the fight against Jack Hermanson. I know that was a split decision win, if I'm not mistaken, that he had there. But he was able to get it done. But where did Cannonier win against Hermanson? Crash that distance, and he's able to get those wins. Can he crash that distance against Sean Strickland? That's my big question in this fight.
I definitely favor the volume of Strickland, but I just wonder about how many power shots he can eat from a guy like Jared Cannonier. I remember way back when David Branch was going to be the next big thing. It was, hey, look who's new in town. It's David Branch. Jared Cannonier beat the brakes off him, and it wasn't even close. Like, David Branch is a really talented grappler, and Jared Cannonier, he excels in striking when you are a wrestler. Like, when you try to take him down, he's a good enough wrestler to defend a lot of your takedown attempts and expose your weaknesses on the feet. He's not matched up with that kind of a style in this matchup. I just don't know how willing Sean Strickland's going to be to really exchange volume strikes in the pocket with a guy like Cannonier. Because I look at Cannonier and some of the recent fights he's had, and I think about the Kelvin Gastelum matchup. I know Kelvin Gastelum was not thought about in his prime when he fought Jared Cannonier, similar to Uriah Hall when he fought Sean Strickland. But I still think that that is a fight that you can look at and take some positives from. He was able to hurt Gastelum when Gastelum was moving in. He was only able to score one knockdown in that fight, but still, it was a good shot where he caught a good boxer making his way in. And I think Sean Strickland's going to have to fight in a similar way. I think Strickland's going to be the more likely to move forward because Cannonier, it's a bit of a gift, but it's also a bit of a curse. He's not the most active guy throughout his fights. Even go back to the Jack Hermanson fight. Hermanson wins that first round, does a lot of unorthodox movements, but Cannonier's willing to lose the battle to win the war. And that's where his power really does come into effect. And I can see this being another one of those fights where Sean Strickland's looking great for three rounds. He's out there volume striking. All of a sudden in the fourth round, similar to Michael Johnson when he fought Josh Emmett, Jared Cannonier is able to hit him with one of those really big shots on the inside. I wouldn't be surprised by that result whatsoever. I just think for these guys, only one of them can kind of still stay in that top seven, top six in the division. And one of them's then going to be relegated kind of where Derek Brunson was a few years ago. So I think this is a very important fight for both guys at this stage of their careers.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at it right now, they're going to have to change the poster because Cannonier was number two when they put the poster out. Now he's number three. Strickland on the Sunday that we tape this is number seven. And if you do consider this in terms of like trade trees, if you're a big like other sports fan of all the other big leagues, like NHL, there's always those trade trees that go on for years. For Sean Strickland, the Extreme Couture cornering tree, Chris Curtis cornered Roman Dolidze. Roman won. Sean Strickland cornered Chris Curtis. Chris Curtis won. So can Sean Strickland continue that? And who's going to be the middleweight that corners him in this fight? There's a lot of them that train out of that camp. So if you look at this one in terms of the odds, Cannonier open minus 150, plus 100. Sean Strickland open plus 130, minus 120. So the odds are close, but they're going in favor of Strickland. And if we have a look at the Tapology votes, record scratch, this one is over in our YouTube community tab. You guys do a great job responding over there and tossing out those poll votes. 65% going with Cannonier. I can see on our Instagram poll at Fight Night Picks, it's pretty much the same. So 65% Cannonier, who's now the underdog. Out of all of the comments, MMA Investing saying, think Cannonier's leg kicks will be the difference. I can see Strickland outboxing him for the majority of the fight, but the leg kicks will add up, and his stance and style leave him very susceptible to a guy who smashes low leg kicks, kind of like Blachowicz versus Ankalaev. Tyler saying, I like Sean in this. Possibly Jared could get a finish, but unlikely. Angel or Angel 111, Strickland by decision. And Kyle saying, not quite a hot take, but either Cannonier by knockout or Strickland by boring decision. So in this one, the fans have Cannonier. I'll look at Tapology. The fans also have Cannonier. And the odds are going in favor of Strickland. Does that concern you? Does that puzzle you?
If I pick Cannonier, Sean Strickland's going to outstrike him for 25 minutes. And if I pick Sean Strickland, Jared Cannonier's going to knock him out in the second round. It's a really close fight, even though it might not be close by the time the fight's over. It's one of those really weird matchups. Because Cannonier does excel when he's fighting wrestlers, even though he is not a great wrestler. He is one of those weird fighters who's cut from the cloth of, hey, whatever you're bad at, I'm going to try to exploit that part of your game. I do like Cannonier, though, as the underdog. And someone brought it up in the comments section. How'd he beat Anderson Silva? Kicked him in the legs. Like, leg kicks are a pretty integral part of Jared Cannonier's
game. I thought Anderson Silva wins didn't matter.
They don't. Again, he beat him via injury. This is my whole point, though. Jerick Cannonier has great leg kicks. Jerick Cannonier even kicked Robert Whittaker in the leg. Robert Whittaker, though, can use his footwork to evade a lot of those strikes. Sean Strickland, for as good of a volume striker as he is, he's a very come forward and try to meet you striker, and I don't think that's the kind of striker who excels against Cannonier. I think you got to use a lot of your footwork, and I just don't think Sean Strickland's going to be doing that in this matchup.
To me, Sean Strickland's footwork isn't something that evades him from round one to round five. Now, it does scare you with the knockout loss that he had to Pereira. Obviously, the loss years ago to Zaleski Dos Santos, who, man, you saw it that late in your career? Like, that's going to become the issue. But when you do look at it for Strickland, the thing that does scare me, though, is it's not big movements in and out. It's not a ton of head movement. It's walk forward, walk back, walk forward, walk back. If speed walking and races were a thing, Sean Strickland would probably win all of them. I do like Sean Strickland with the volume. The thing that scares me out of Cannonier, though, is it's that low volume, brooding, waiting, leg kick, big shot, whiff on wind, and then reset, and then he's got to go back into it. And at that point, Sean Strickland's continued to throw the volume. So in terms of a fight with damage, Jerick Cannonier definitely has a great opportunity in this fight. But we'll be split on the pick of this main event. It comes down to the crucial end of the year on this card, Matt. And we have a big-time card. Like we said at the start, 9 ranked fighters on this card. You get that Ryzen Bellator card, New Year's Eve, to get excited about. We get some fun things that are going to drop throughout the holidays. I know people always like those year-end award shows. We have some fun with that. We dress up for those, too. I don't know. I know. I'm there for them. Okay, Matt. So coming out hot at the end. But
I'm really excited for this card, though. I really like the last two fight night cards that we have had to end this year. The UFC, they don't really have like a prime season. There's not really a playoffs. I know during the summer there's International Fight Week, and in the past they've had some of those bigger press conferences where they try to promote some of the other fight night cards. But I really do like the strength of schedule, at least, that we've had out of some of these fight night cards as of late. The last one was very good. The last pay-per-view might not have wowed people, but entertainment-wise, we had some great fights on that one as well. And I think these fights are all very tightly contested, and that's what makes a great fight night card like this. It might not have the big names on it, but there's a lot of really close fights, and that's really all you can ask for as an MMA fan. A
lot of great fights. Again, make sure you comment down below if you're not subscribed already. There's quite a few of you that aren't. Toss that. Just hit that button, toss the like, all of that good stuff to really, really end the year on a high note. A great week with UFC 282, and looking forward to a great one with Fight Night. Cannonier versus Strickland coming up this weekend. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.